You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
This is Jeff Blankford with the July 12th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. Even before the revelations of Donald Trump Jr.'s exchange of emails with Russian lawyer Natalia Veselnitskaya, it has been open season on the Kremlin among both members of Congress and the U.S. media that is as intensive as I recollect it as almost at any time during the Cold War. But now it is the Democrats and self-proclaimed liberals who are leading the charge, with three failed Republican presidential candidates, Senators Lindsey Graham, John McCain, and Marco Rubio, providing them with a verbal equivalent of hellfire missiles. They were not needed by MSNBC's Rachel Maddow on the night of President Trump's two-hour visit with Russia's Vladimir Putin. She was ready with a vicious diatribe targeting Russia's president and a prepared special segment hosted by former NBC correspondent Richard Engel that attempted to portray Putin in the words of former Russian chess champion Garry Kasparov, who Engel interviewed, as the greatest threat to life on the planet. Berkeley Congresswoman Barbara Lee, who had been a lone vote in the House opposing the Iraq War, tweeted, "Outraged by President Trump's two-hour meeting with Putin, the man who orchestrated attacks on our democracy, where do his loyalties lie?" End quote. Well, aside from the fact that no evidence for such orchestration by Putin has been presented to the public, nor for that matter for the health of our democracy, pre-Trump, would she actually prefer fighting to talking? And here is Charles Blow, in Monday's New York Times, seeming to question Trump's meeting with Putin, quote, "the man whose thumb," he wrote, "was all over the scale that delivered Trump's victory," end quote. It was like a father meeting his offspring. Well, it was left to Bill O'Reilly's replacement at Fox News, Tucker Carlson, to interview Professor Stephen Cohen, a thoughtful, sober expert on Russian affairs, to provide a rare dissenting view. Dissenting views, as you have learned by now, are what you will generally hear on Takes on the World, and today is no exception. At approximately 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking once again with investigative journalist Gareth Porter, getting his take on Trump's meeting with Putin and the media's response to it, as well as discussing his recent article for Consortium News, foisting blame for cyber hacking on the Russians. So stay tuned for that. Admittedly, Trump should have anticipated that his meeting with Putin, whatever its length, would be a lose-lose situation for him. He didn't make it any better when, given the ongoing investigations on Capitol Hill, he suggested the two countries partner in a cybersecurity effort. "I'm sure that Vladimir Putin would be enormous assistance in that effort since he's doing the hacking," quipped Senator John McCain on CBS's Face the Nation, where he is a reliable fixture. Senator Graham, whose anti-Russian attitude is equaled only by McCain, had told NBC's Meet the Press that working with Russia on cybersecurity was, quote, "not the dumbest idea I've ever heard, but it's pretty close," saying that Trump's apparent willingness to, quote, "forgive and forget," stiffened his resolve to pass legislation imposing additional sanctions on Russia. You may recall, in one of my past programs, I played the audio from a video of Graham and McCain meeting with Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko and a group of Ukrainian soldiers, urging them not to carry the war to the Russians. Well, the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, Southern California Adam Schiff, a frequent guest on NPR, told CNN's State of the Union program that Russia could not be a credible partner in the kind of cybersecurity unit that Trump suggested. "It's our best election defense. If that's our best election defense, we might as well just mail our ballot boxes to Moscow," end quote. Well, that helped to distract the media from focusing on the ceasefire agreement Trump negotiated with Putin over Southwest Syria that seems to be holding, as it didn't rate even a mention in a single word in today's New York Times. Well, each day seems to bring a new and bewildering chapter in the Russiagate story, the latest being a meeting with Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, the country's first son-in-law, and former Trump campaign director Paul Manafort, with a Russian lawyer, Veselnitskaya, who claimed to have information that would damage Hillary Clinton's election chances. Yesterday, the younger Donald released all the emails leading up to the meeting that seemed to contradict the way that Trump Sr. and his overworked spin doctors had described it. The press and the politicians' reaction to that story when it broke caught the attention of Consortium News' Robert Perry, also a frequent guest on this program. Perry pointed out that the different reaction by all parties to the latest frenzy over a meeting between Trump Jr. and the Russian lawyer, who was dangling the possibility of information about the Democrats receiving money from Russians, and the report during the campaign that Clinton supporters had paid large sums of money to, quote, have ex-British spy Christopher Steele use his Russian connections to dig up dirt on Trump inside Russia, resulting in a salacious dossier that Clinton backers eagerly hawked to the news media, end quote. The different reactions of the two reports, writes Perry, represents one of the more remarkable moments of the entire Russiagate hysteria, end quote. Also, he notes, the two events, Trump Jr.'s meeting with a Russian lawyer and the Clinton camp's commissioning of Steele's Russia dossier, both occurred in June 2016, so you might have thought it would be a journalistic imperative to incorporate a reference or two to the dossier. And that's Robert Perry. Well, most, if not all of us, including Trump's victory, can be traced back to the U.S. orchestrated coup in Ukraine in 2014, the evidence of which was contained in two audio clips that I played twice for you on Takes on the World. The first was a clip of a videoed speech by Victoria Nuland, Clinton's former press spokeswoman, who, after Clinton resigned, was appointed by Obama to serve as Deputy Secretary of State for Europe and Asia. Listeners heard her telling a group of Ukrainian Americans that Washington had spent $5 billion, that's billion with a B, trying to create regime change in their homeland. The second was an audio of a phone call between Nuland and Jeff Pyatt, the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, before the coup, discussing who should be appointed prime minister in a new Ukrainian government. Nuland, obviously calling the shots in the conversation, tells Pyatt that it should be Yats, the nickname they had adopted for Arseniy Yatsenyuk, and not Klitsch, the nickname they had given former heavyweight boxing champ Vladimir Klitschko, who was also involved in the Maidan Square protest. As it turned out, Yats got the job. What's important to know, as I mentioned before, is that Nuland is the wife of Robert Kagan, co-founder with Bill Kristol of PNAC, a group of pro-Israel anti-Russian neocons that called itself the Project for New American Century. It came together during Bill Clinton's presidency, largely ignored by the mainstream media, undetected by the left, despite the presence of major Washington figures such as Elliot Abrams, Dick Cheney, Francis Fukuyama, Steve Forbes, and Norman Podoritz as signatories. It called for Washington to eliminate any threat to its global domination, and first on its agenda was the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. To accomplish that, a number of PNACers managed to get appointed to the Bush administration's inner circle, including Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz. Both claimed credit for orchestrating the war in Iraq, with Doug Feith being allowed to set up an Office of Special Plans designed to produce the fake news about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction to justify it. Though elected as an anti-war candidate in January 2009, even before he was sworn in office, with the support of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, President-elect Obama effectively pardoned and protected those responsible for the war, telling the American public, quote, we need to look forward, not backward, end quote. Mesmerized by the presence of the first African-American in the White House, what anti-war movement that existed rolled over on its back and never made an effort to regain its footing. It continued that way for 8 years despite Obama's expansion of the drone wars, his assassination program, his support of the Saudi war in Yemen, the insertion of U.S. troops in Syria, and his expanding of the U.S. military footprint across the African continent. When the situation in Iraq under Bush began to unravel, PNAC dissolved without any fanfare, later to reappear as a foreign policy initiative with the same Robert Kagan and Bill Kristol as co-founders. The FBI and a sister organization, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, like PNAC, has managed to evade the scrutiny of the left for reasons I will let you speculate, but you will occasionally hear its director, Mark Dubowitz, being interviewed on NPR regarding Iran, where his views are predictably hawkish. That the neocons had been thwarted by the election of Obama was a pleasant myth pushed by some liberal commentators who had never mentioned them in the first place and thus ignored their presence in the Clinton State Department. Before being hired by Clinton as her press spokeswoman, Victoria Nuland was a high-level advisor to Dick Cheney, a fact that apparently was not mentioned by the press in keeping with its silence about her marriage to Kagan. Hubby Robert was not idle. During the 2004 election, he served as John McCain's foreign policy advisor. And what did you know? After her appointment as Secretary of State, who should she pick as her foreign policy advisor but Kagan? Thus, it should come as no surprise that Kagan was among the first to endorse her candidacy last spring, writing that while she would not admit it publicly, her foreign policy was that of the neocons. Recall that during the campaign, Clinton was quick to say that she would stand up to Putin. She called for a no-fly zone over Syria without qualifications, which drew a warning about the possible consequences of a clash with Russia from General Dumford, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. If she had been elected, we would have likely seen that implemented. She had repeatedly called for it over Obama's objections, as she had successfully pushed for overthrowing Gaddafi in Libya, despite the president's reluctance to get involved there. Clinton was also a strong supporter of NATO and its moving of troops toward Russia's borders, which violated an agreement made by the first George Bush administration with Mikhail Gorbachev. This was then legitimized by Washington and its allies when Putin responded to the coup in Kiev, stage managed by Nuland, by annexing Crimea and supporting resistance to the coup plotters by the Russian-speaking eastern Ukraine. That move was no doubt anticipated by Washington, since Crimea had historically provided Russia with its only warm water outlet, and which for that reason the Russians still maintained a naval base with 25,000 troops in Sevastopol long after Nikita Khrushchev had signed Crimea over to Ukraine. None of this background seems to be of sufficient importance to the mainstream media that they choose to inform their readers about it. In fact, we are told, all the problems began with Russia's seizure of Crimea, which we are rarely told but had been part of Russia for most of its modern existence. The coup that forced out Ukraine's elected president, Viktor Yanukovych, is rarely ever mentioned 3 years after it happened, nor is the fact that it occurred immediately after he had made agreement with the EU to hold an election after which he would peacefully step down. The most right-wing of the protesters in Maidan stepped up their attacks on Yanukovych and forced him to flee for his life. Apparently a peaceful transit in their nor Washington's interests. Ditto, apparently, for the New York Times' David Sanger, who in Monday's paper described a meeting between Secretary of State Rex Tillerson with Ukraine's President Poroshenko, who Sanger tells his readers, quote, took office after one of Mr. Putin's acolytes was pushed from power, end quote. One of Putin's acolytes is how Sanger describes an elected president of a European country who is chased from office by a U.S.-orchestrated coup as if his name is of no consequences. While Yanukovych was supported by Putin, only an ignorant U.S. journalist would portray him as an acolyte. Back in 2004, according to a BBC profile, Yanukovych had openly been supported by Putin, but relations became strained, not least because of a dispute about the cost of Russian gas. Yanukovych tried hard to shed the image of being a Moscow man, and when he became president, he pointedly made his first foreign trip as president to Brussels rather than Moscow. During his presidency, according to the BBC, Yanukovych steered Ukraine toward a closer relationship with the EU. But then in November 2013, days before it was due to be signed, he rejected an association agreement with the EU. With Ukraine's finances in a precarious state, he argued that free trade ties with the EU would jeopardize Ukraine's existing trade with Russia, an argument that was supported by Russian-speaking eastern Ukraine but rejected by the more European-oriented west of the country. Yanukovych said he could only sign an agreement with EU if it provided the country with substantial financial compensation. The EU refused, and the rest is history. However, it's only logical that Putin would have done whatever was in his power to defeat Hillary Clinton. Despite the fact that Russia had not attacked the United States or ever threatened to do so, she was portraying him as an implacable enemy of the American people and our way of life. But there was not a single shred of evidence presented to the public that he tried to push the elections in Trump's favor. the fact that the statements repeated over and over and over by the mainstream media, the 17 U.S. intelligence agencies concluded that Russia was behind the hacking of the Democratic National Committees and John Podesta's emails doesn't make it any more true today than when the lie was first told.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine. In March of 2017, the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs held one of its spectacular conferences featuring a wide range of Palestinian voices. We will be featuring some of those voices in the weeks to come, and begin this week with one of the most courageous of those voices, Hanan Eshwari, most famous for the role she played as the voice of the PLO during some of its most crucial negotiations. We begin with her introduction to the conference.
I'm Delinda Hanley, the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs news editor and executive director of the American Educational Trust. Dr. Hanan Eshwari has broken through the glass ceiling that can prevent women around the world from reaching the top. She was the first woman to be elected a member of the Executive Committee of the Palestinian Liberation Organization in 2009. She served as the official spokesperson of the Palestinian delegation to the Middle East peace process from 1991 to 1993 and participated in the 1991-1992 Madrid Peace Conference. In 1993, Dr. Eshwari founded the Palestinian Independent Commission for Citizens' Rights, PICCR, to investigate Israeli and Palestinian human rights violations, recording her experiences in This Side of Peace, a personal account which she just signed at lunchtime. In 1996, Eshwari was elected and subsequently reelected many times to the Palestinian Legislative Council. In 1996, she also accepted the post of Minister of Higher Education and Research. In 1998, Eshwari founded and continues to serve as Miftah in the Palestinian Initiative for the Promotion of Global Dialogue and Democracy. It is not hyperbolic to say that Dr. Eshwari has also broken through the Palestinian sound barrier, the wall of silence in America's media, which excludes Palestinian voices. She is the Palestinian Iron Dome. Whenever Israel sends warplanes, troops, and weaponized drones to attack her people, we can count on Hanan Eshwari to be out there trying to stop the bombs and the Israeli propaganda. Her only weapon, her articulate, reasonable voice, and demand for justice and fair play. She will address the Israel lobby and the peace process. Welcome, Hanan Eshwari.
Thank you very much. Thank you. This is indeed heartwarming and humbling. I thank you all for coming. Thank you, Delinda, for your invitation. Thank you, Grant. Thank you, Jan, for picking me up also, and all the people who made this possible. I'm delighted to be here with you, and I'm delighted to be part of this occasion, this endeavor, which in many ways is extremely timely. And it does respond to a sense of urgency, really, a need to intervene and to shape policy and discourse. And it's wonderful to hear all these, not just distinguished people, but very profound and persuasive people and courageous people, really, who are speaking truth to power and who are standing up for justice. I don't want to waste too much time because I have a lot to say. So you have to let me know ahead of time. As you know, this is a very significant occasion because we're talking about 100, 70, 50, and 0. 100 years since the Balfour Declaration, and I do hope that the Brits will not celebrate it, even though Theresa May invited Netanyahu to celebrate with her. This is the colonial legacy par excellence. 70 years since the partition plan that did partition Palestine and created the State of Israel, at that time on 55% of Palestine. 50 years since the occupation of 1967, and zero time for the two-state solution. So I'm asked to talk about the Israel lobby and the peace process. I will focus on the peace process because you all know that the Israel lobby is never absent. Whenever anything happens related to Palestine, it is there. And when it comes to the peace process, they have always been a shaping force, intertwining, interweaving, intervening their presence, and at the same time maintaining their, I don't want to say control, but their influence every step of the way. They played a major role in shaping and influencing U.S. policy, particularly the peace process, and since its inception. There's a sense of ownership that the peace process is owned by the Israeli lobby in many ways because they're looking out for the interests of Israel all the time. There were various components of the lobby. As you all know, they're not monolithic. They all had their impact here and there, but the most significant impact is for the lobby groups, the special interest groups that are closest to the Israeli government in particular, and that tends to be the more hardline extremist groups, even though there were different voices, but the greatest impact was by the more extreme voices. Most influential, of course, AIPAC and its Washington Institute for Near East Policy, as you know, as a think tank that has probably had the most direct say in terms of the peace process itself, and other organizations, Heritage Foundation and so on. So you have all these organizations that move from the extreme right to the center, like J Street that was being discussed before this talk. And they all have a different type, set of requirements and different ways of intervening. There are different spheres and players. There's a diversity in the pro-Israel lobby. There's the private sector. And as you know, Adelson was trying to buy a president here, but he's also buying a prime minister in Israel. Moscovitz, who bought settlements, who built settlements in Jerusalem. These are individuals in the private sector that have had a direct impact and direct intervention using their money. Haim Saban, in, as you know, in Brookings, and down to the left, Danny Abraham, who has accompanied the peace process all along from a more liberal perspective. There are institutions and think tanks, individuals linked to them. The most significant, and you'll hear me talk about him often, not because I like him very much, but because he has been the most persistent, Dennis Ross, and in and out, and Martin Indyk and others. Then you have academic and cultural individuals and spin doctors who have been a primary force in shaping public perceptions, including, you know, Krauthammer, Dershowitz. I'm sure you're hearing him now. Daniel Pipes. There are lots of people who are Israeli apologists and spin doctors. Then you have religious organizations and institutions, self-appointed Israeli apologists and defenders who take the Bible literally, many of them. And this is the extreme Zionist Christian organizations. They are extremely dangerous in the sense that they do have a literal biblical exegesis that gives Israel license to do whatever it wants. And one of them told me once, you Palestinians have no right to exist because you're standing in the way of prophecy, of the fulfillment of the prophecy. So I said, it doesn't sound very Christian when you advocate genocide. And then there are toxic organizations, as you know, and they have been very effective in distorting the Palestinian message and reality, like MEMRI, you know, M-E-M-R-I. You should be aware of this. This is the most toxic organization. It is run by Yigal Carmon, who used to be the advisor to the military governor, then he became the advisor to Shamir on terrorism and so on, and he used to interrogate me once in a while. But now he has this organization with tremendous funds, and he monitors everything, and then he has access to Congress particularly, but to many decision makers, and he distorts Palestinian utterance and anything that is published. We can talk about this later. You have Memory, you have NGO Monitor that attempts to badmouth all Palestinian NGOs. You have the PM Watch, which is also waiting for any Palestinian to open his or her mouth, and they attack. And then you have publications. I'm sure you're hearing more and more about Breitbart, for example, Gladstone. Mm-hmm. These are extreme right-wing white supremacists. Some of them are really anti-Semitic, but Zionist. Very interesting, this combination. Now, they influenced substance, structure, procedure, and priorities and objectives in the peace process. They influenced terms of reference, and they influenced also the players, and predominantly the U.S. role in the peace process. I would like to mention that many of the individuals who were associated follow the what I call revolving door. They use the revolving door as a charge against Palestinians, that when people are arrested, they are released later. But here, revolving door in terms of their role. Many of them were in the State Department. And it seems that, like Dennis and Martin, that they do go to the State Department and then they leave and go to the Washington Institute or another pro-Israeli lobby. Then they come back through another door there in the State Department. Now we have people in the White House who are not only lobbyists and advocates, but who are active supporters of settlements. So it's not enough to have settlers in the Israeli coalition government. Now you have settlers in the White House. This is incredible. So they don't need to lobby. They are decision makers, right? So that's what's happening. That frames, in terms of influence, the peace process with this revolving door. You'll be surprised also that Israel's ex-ambassador Dan Shapiro, for example, decided to stay in Israel, and he's joined the Institute for National Security Studies, which is something that also Dennis joined at one point or another, Dennis Ross. So it's interchangeable. You know, either they are influencing policy or they are making policy. And that's why American policy was so distorted, because they played a significant role in framing and defining the discourse and perceptions, but went beyond that to manipulating the verbal public space, anything related to the peace process, and they generated a narrative based on myths and provided alternative facts. It's not Kellyanne who invented alternative facts. We've been victims of alternative facts all our lives, you know? Alternative realities. They've certainly willfully misled public opinion with their fabric. I don't want to go into details about the spin, about the Hasbara, as they call it, but it has been very active in shaping public perceptions and hence attitudes. So a distorted pattern emerged that was totally weighted in favor of the occupation, generating a cyclical pattern, a vicious cycle, that totally subverted progress and led to the current impasse, which has been in the making for quite a long time, since the beginning. And they ensured that the peace process maintained its parameters within the domain of Israeli priorities and interests. So now we are back at the beginning. I wanted to read you a quotation which from a paper in 1991, a position paper by the Washington Institute for Near East Affairs. And guess who wrote this? Martin Indyk. This is March 4, 1991, just before the peace process started, when President Bush and James Baker were preparing for the 1991 Madrid process. And some of the things he says, I mean, could have been said, are being said right now. That's why I call it a cyclical pattern. He says, Israel now has a golden opportunity to deal with an indigenous Palestinian leadership in their territories before the PLO phoenix rises again. It's true the prime minister leads an unruly coalition of right-wing and religious parties unwilling to countenance territorial compromise in the West Bank. But if there is a genuine offer of peace from the Arab side, outside in, he's acceptable to delivering a territorial compromise on the Golan Heights and an interim deal for Palestinian self-government, which leaves open the final status of the territories. This is the ongoing policy. I mean, all you need to do is go to the Washington Institute website, and you will find all these policy papers. Now, there's another one. I'm not going to read all these things, but this one is the Transition 2017 Toward a New Paradigm for Addressing the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict, David Makovsky and Dennis Ross, Washington Institute. And this is another blueprint that was prepared to give to your new President Trump, and you have my full sympathy. On how to address, because they want to confiscate the language once again and confiscate the process once again and decide how it's going to proceed. Anyway, so the peace process in terms, conceptually, the influence was on the terms of reference. They made sure it dealt only with 242338, not other resolutions, because 242338 deal with 67. They don't deal with 48 or the roots of the conflict, if you call it a conflict. They also made sure that there was no reference to sovereignty or statehood for the Palestinians, no reference to the roots of the conflict, including the refugees and so on, 1948, 181, resolution 181. No international law. It must not apply. Only what the parties agree to. In this asymmetry of power where you have occupier and occupied, you go and talk and you agree and we'll agree with whatever you decide. And of course, they used the Egyptian-Israeli Camp David Accords in order to define Palestinian objectives or rights as autonomous. We need autonomy, functional autonomy, or self-government for the people, as though the Israeli control is a given. And therefore you deal with self-government for Palestinians. No reference to Palestine as a country or the Palestinians as a people or a nation. You've heard this construct, Israel and Palestinians. It's never Israel and Palestine. It's never Israel and the Palestinians. It's Israel and Palestinians that we found by the wayside. No. And again, I mean, look, Nikki Haley at the UN voted against Salam Fayyad, vetoed the appointment of Salam Fayyad as Deputy Secretary General to Guterres. Why? Because the appointment had the word Palestine. So we are guilty for existing. We are guilty because we have an identity. We are guilty because we are members of Palestine, the Palestinian nation. Now, of course, you've read Uri Savir's article on Madrid, too, or Moshe Yaalon's new article on let's give the Palestinians autonomy, or Netanyahu's speeches here and there, particularly in Australia, when he talked about transitional phases and functional approach. We will get to that later. But you have enough literature to see where they're heading with that. Now, on substance, the priority, of course, for the peace process was Israel's security. That was the primary objective. And Israel's security is defined in military terms and maintaining military control. Now, let us talk, if you want a demilitarized state minus or entity, then if you want a state minus, then it has to be demilitarized, and Israel has to have full military control, especially and control over the borders, the airspace, territorial waters, and with troop presence. And, of course, they want the Palestinian Authority to be the security subcontractor. You know why Congress in its overzealousness wanted to cut off all funds to the Palestinians. There was a resolution, what's her name? I forgot her name. Anyway, she's the one who always comes up with these interesting resolutions about the Palestinian culpability a priori. Kay Granger. She's any of you from Florida? You're really blessed with two. Kay Granger and what's her name? Russ Littinen. Yeah, the hyphenated name. It's obsessive with them. Anyway, but they've decided that they should cut off all funds from the Palestinians. Then AIPAC went to them and said, no, you can't cut off funds to the security forces. You have to keep paying the Palestinian security forces because they're good for Israel's security. Really? It's AIPAC that wanted funding for the Palestinian security force. So they want a subcontractor, and that to them is the primary function of any Palestinian security force. But also, funnily enough, this doesn't have to do with security, but I always like to say this, that the Congress, in its overzealousness to protect Israel, who was it? I think Jim was talking about how, or Nick, about how they are overzealous. Sometimes they want to outdo AIPAC, Congress members. Yeah, and their overzealousness to serve Israel and protect Israel, they took resolutions that gave us enormous power. They took resolutions that any organization which accepts Palestinian membership will be defunded by the U.S., and they will not pay their fees. They took resolutions that convention or agreement that we accede to and so on will not be supported by the U.S. So what's happening? We told them, fine, we are going to join all of them. This means the U.S. will be isolated because it will have to leave all of them. So can you imagine what happens when we join WIPO, intellectual property? What will happen to all the patents and intellectual property of the U.S.? Or when we decide to join the Atomic Energy Commission? But they say if you join these things and if you accede to any agreement or convention, that you will be punished. We will not fund you. Well, thank you very much. Let's accede and see what happens to the U.S. when it has no say in any international organization. Anyway, that's overzealousness. Sometimes you go overboard when you punish yourself. And not only that, but we were supposed to be held as... I said this before, forgive me if I quote myself. It became a famous quote, I think. That we are being held responsible for the safety of our occupiers. That the Israeli settlers and the Israeli army can do whatever they want to us, and we are responsible for their safety. No Palestinian can react, not even in self-defense, because automatically the terrorist label comes out, and like a post-it, it's on your forehead, you're terrorist. Because a 14-year-old dared attempt to strike at a soldier with carrying scissors. She was carrying scissors, but he was on Palestinian land as an occupation soldier, wearing bulletproof vests, wearing a helmet, and carrying a machine gun and at a checkpoint on her own land. But she's the terrorist, he's the victim. And she was the one who was shot. So anyway, we are responsible for the safety of our occupiers. The Israeli army can go into Areas A, and I hate this designation, but Areas A in which they're not supposed to come in, and they can arrest, they can blow up homes, they can do whatever they want at will. But should the Palestinian security forces try to stop them, they're in serious trouble. They cannot. They're not supposed to stand up to the Israeli army. And should any Palestinian react to this intense injustice, then he or she is a terrorist. Now, in terms of the regional dimension, of course, it has become very clear and it has come back to haunt us. Now it is called the outside-in approach, and it's a very sexy term now. I'm sure you've read this in all the new proposed approaches to peacemaking. Outside-in. Let's go to the Arabs. Let's go to the region. Let's put the API, the Arab Peace Initiative, on its head. Let's normalize with the Arabs, and then we can deal with the Palestinians. This was, from the beginning, the Israeli lobby approach. Two tracks, Palestinian-Israeli track, Arab-Israeli track, bilateral track, multilateral track. Normalize, bring the Arabs to normalization with Israel, and then the Palestinians will fall in step. Not just that, but you transform the Palestinian issue into a domestic issue within Israel. We can control, we'll deal with them. Therefore, it becomes a question of controlling the people in Palestine. And we are a domestic issue. I'm sure many of you have read Herzog's 10-point plan. Herzog is supposed to represent the more moderate, what has become the Labour Party in Israel, that has been renamed as the Zionist camp, because they have to compete with Likud on Likud terms. You know, they have to show they are more right-wing and hardline than the Likud. Now he has a plan, 10-point plan. Again, functional approach. Again, gradual approach. Put the Palestinians on probation. We can. I will talk about this later. But this is Netanyahu's constant theme, that the Palestinians live in population centers, fragmented and localized. And of course, the approach now is back to the village league's approach. If you remember, many of you are young enough not to remember, but some of you are old enough to remember, the attempts to establish village leagues, localized communities, community centers, and so on. But it takes us back even further, where you can find collaborators who will collaborate with the occupation and run our lives. It takes us back to the Balfour Declaration, right? Didn't he say they want to establish a national home for the Jews, but at the same time a state? Keeping in mind what the interests or the well-being without prejudicing the non-Jewish communities in Palestine. We are being now addressed as the non-Jewish communities in Palestine. Excuse me, I mean, the majority and the basis were Palestinian, Christian, Muslim, and Jewish. And some atheists, but they couldn't be officially atheists anyway. That's a majority. We're not the exception as being non-Jewish. Now it's the minority that has become the defining factor. Now we are the non-Jewish community. So we are back to 100 years ago. Of course, there were attempts at bringing together some Arab countries, like the Aqaba meeting, in order to come up with an agreement with Israel. This time it was Netanyahu who scuttled it. And the whole approach, of course, is the substance, is not ending the occupation, but carrying out administrative functions, economic ease, the quality of life argument, which is now part of the Green Blood platform. And I remember when they offered us in the early 1980s to run our lives. They said, you can have all the powers and responsibilities of the civil administration. We said, no, thank you. We don't want to work for the occupation. We want the occupation to leave. Then we can run our lives. Excuse me. So now this has become another focus. We are going back to the beginning and even pre-peace process. 4, maintain the strategic alliance between U.S. and Israel. This was a constant focus of the peace process. And it was brought to bear on everything that was done in that context. It thus enhanced the power asymmetry and the imbalance until now. The features of this alliance was accommodate Israeli priorities and demands, adopt their own diction and perspective. I was going to say fiction. Yes, most of it is fiction and perspectives. Always frame the relationship in terms of the Judeo-Christian traditions. Remember? And shared values. So I keep asking my American friends, what shared values? The values of occupation, of enslavement of a people, of impunity, of oppressing a whole nation, of carrying out extrajudicial executions, of demolishing homes, of stealing other people's lands, and so on. Are these the values you want to share with Israel? Is this the Judeo-Christian tradition? I don't know. I mean, really. And to me, it's very strange, because automatically, the moment you find this fusion Judeo-Christian, you are excluding Islamic, Buddhist, any other tradition that does not belong to this club. And to me, Islam is one of the most tolerant religions because it doesn't deny the existence of the others. It builds on Judaism and Christianity, while Judaism and Christianity supposedly cancel each other out, don't they? Anyway. And of course, the other myth is that Israel is the only democracy in the region. You hear that all the time. This is part of this alliance. Even Theresa May talked about this when she criticized John Kerry for not vetoing the 2334 resolution on settlements. How dare you criticize the only democracy in the region and our best friend, our ally? And the Palestinians, of course, are the alien, the other, the fearful, the incomprehensible, and even the Orientalist glasses, to quote Edward Said, the late Edward Said, have come out again. And, of course, there is an automatic linkage between terrorism and Islam. And now it's becoming much more evident. See, never surprise Israel with any American statement, position, or document related to the peace process. This I know from experience, and they will admit it. The American team, they always coordinated with the Israelis first on any American position, and they always cleared it up ahead of time with the Israelis. And if you have the Greenblatt Friedman plan, also you should read it. It is called the policy paper for Trump. He was candidate Trump, then it became Trump's policy paper on Israel. You will see how toxic it has become. And it was read by him as an AIPAC speech. Again, never allow or express any public censure or criticism of Israel. That's why they became so very acted in such a historical manner. Sorry. thank you. They waxed ballistic just for the mere fact that the U.S. abstained on settlements. When a few years earlier, they had vetoed a resolution on settlements, which violate international law and so on. Therefore, they're not used to accepting any kind of criticism or censure, let alone sanctions. Always use the positive approach with Israel. Incentives, rewards, advance payments, inducements, and so on. When we started the talks, they immediately got the Zionism is racism resolution repeal, nullified. You know that. And then they got that, diplomatic recognition, trade agreements, and so on. Another thing, of course, in incentivizing Israel, including Europe, and I can give you many examples how Europe used this approach too. Conversely, you use pressure, threats, and blackmail on the Palestinians. Exploit the weakness of Palestine and augmenting Israeli power and control. Of course, this was a special contribution of AIPAC, ZOA, and others, the Council of Presidents, in drafting congressional resolutions that always adopted punitive measures against the Palestinians, especially if we joined organizations like the ICC and ICJ. How dare you hold Israel accountable? Israel is above the law. Hence, the Palestinians are always on probation, on good behavior. We have to prove that we deserve our rights. We have to prove that we deserve human recognition. It's a test. We have to demonstrate that we are worthy, a test of merit. I'm sure you've read Dershowitz's horrible article posted on the Gatestone Institute website, in which he says Palestinians must earn the two-state solution. And, of course, he proceeded to give a fake version of history. I have news for him. The Palestinians don't think that the two-state solution is a fair or just solution. It was a major, painful compromise by the Palestinians. So it's not our aspiration to give away 78% of our land. It is a compromise that we made in order to give our children a future and a life in freedom and dignity and to exercise our right to self-determination. And now Israel and probably the world are not very keen on seeing it happen. I'll get to that later. Now, always blame the Palestinians in the blame game. I can give you many examples from the Clinton parameters. Even when there was discussion in Camp David in 2000, I was there. We were told, you will not be blamed. Give it your best shot. And I remember Yasser Arafat told them, we are not ready. The talks have not progressed enough to have a summit in Camp David. Clayton Swisher is here. I don't know if you remember, right? He said, we are not ready. And both Madeleine Albright and Bill Clinton said, give it your best shot. We won't blame you. What happened later? The whole myth of the generous offer. Huh? We were blamed. When there was no offer, I said, show me a concrete offer on the table. There were all these different groups discussing different issues in a fragmented way, but there was no generous offer that the Palestinians... And this myth gained a life of its own, actually. Now, every time you hear an Israeli apologist, he or she will say, you see, the Palestinians refused the generous offer. And we have to earn it anyway. Always blame the Palestinians. We said that, again, the roadmap. Remember the roadmap, 2002-2003? Sharon placed 14 reservations on the roadmap that totally nullified it, negated it. They came out and said the Israelis accepted the roadmap. The Palestinians didn't. The Palestinians accepted the roadmap knowing that it's not perfect or ideal. But we knew that Sharon was rejecting it. So the issue was that Sharon accepted it, and no even footnote about the 14 reservations, but the Palestinians didn't. I don't know where they get their version of history. Again, John Kerry's initiative on 2014, you remember when he tried this initiative, he tried to do more of the same, thinking that he will get a different result, or thinking that he might get one. Anyway, he promised, he said, that any party that scuttles or undermines or rejects or whatever the peace talks will be publicly blamed. So what happened? The Palestinians dutifully went to these negotiations, knowing full well that we took a decision not to go, frankly speaking, because there were no terms of reference, there were no clear objectives, there was nothing to tell Israel to stop settlement activities, to respect signed agreements, to release prisoners, and so on. And John Kerry said, try your best. And he was given a verbal promise, an oral promise by the Israelis, that they will minimize settlements, that they will release prisoners. So what did they do? Immediately they escalated settlements, they escalated violence, they shot a few people on checkpoints, and then they refused to release the last installment of prisoners. So where is the blame? Both sides. They're not ready. What? The Palestinian leadership lost its constituency for going to these negotiations when they weren't assured of the substance and outcome. And the Israelis deliberately violated their commitments and obligations, and they weren't blamed. There were some leaks here and there that the settlements were bad. Now, we have also, in that context, I have to mention this. It's a very racist statement that makes me very angry. Abba Iban said this. The Palestinians never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. It has been used to bash the Palestinians and to feed these misconceptions and distortions forever. So every time you hear this, I think you have to reverse this. It's the Israelis that missed historic opportunities to make peace and totally destroyed the chances of peace. We're not on the defensive. We don't have to prove that we make use of opportunities because we never had one. And, of course, the other terms, you know, like the leitmotifs of our reality have been shaped by the Israeli lobby, like Hamas rockets raining down on Israeli towns and villages. Have you heard this? And it's repeated verbatim by everybody in Congress and outside Congress. Nobody asks how many did they kill, and nobody asks how many Palestinians were killed by the Israeli army, and nobody asks about the siege and the assault and so on. It's as if people in Gaza decided to wake up one day and manufacture these homemade pipes and throw them out of the blue because they're terrorists by definition. And again, Palestinian terrorism, incitement and violence. Now, you cannot mention Israeli settlements without finding a false equivalence with incitement. Palestinians incite. Palestinians incite to violence. Palestinians think that their prisoners are heroes. And they are terrorists. So you adopt the language of the Israelis that everybody who's a Palestinian is a terrorist. But since 1967, Israel has imprisoned more than 800,000 Palestinians, including myself and many others of my friends and so on. I don't think there are 800,000 terrorists, people who did not acquiesce to the occupation or accept to have their spirit broken. These are not terrorists. Israel has killed more than 75,000 Palestinians since 67. Who are the terrorists? Now, again, there are new preconditions. The refusal to recognize Israel as a Jewish state, that's our fault. Either we become Zionists or we are not fit for human company. Again, any criticism of Israel is conflated with anti-Semitism. You've heard this before, so this is one way of censoring and silencing criticism. And the Palestinians are not a peace partner. We don't have a peace partner among the Palestinians. I can't tell you how many types of negotiations there were, and needless negotiations, from direct to indirect to proximity talks to bilateral to multilateral to long-distance talks to exploratory talks, and at the end we even had epistolary talks, exchanges of letters. And we've been talked out, frankly speaking. But it was a good peace process because Israel used it as a cover to create facts on the ground, to negate the very substance and to destroy the objective of the talks. So here we are. Now, while the process is ongoing, never allow any issue critical of Israel to be brought before the UN. This is something ongoing again. Massive lobbying. I don't want to give you too many examples, but we don't have time. I know I've done over my time. Should I stop?
We've got a million questions.
Okay. So use the veto and at the same time protect Israel's impunity, enable Israel, but maintain Palestinian vulnerability. We shouldn't have access to international organizations or international law to protect our rights and our lands, but Israel has the full right to act outside the law. No sanctions or punitive measures from any party on anywhere, no accountability and so on. And this generated a culture of entitlement, exceptionalism, preferential treatment and privilege in Israel, which in itself justifies the subjugation, discrimination, violence and total captivity of the Palestinian people, and especially the continued military assaults on Gaza. Because Palestinian lives in Gaza have been reduced to abstractions. They are numbers. They're not human beings. The murder of civilians doesn't count. It's the fact that there were 70 soldiers were killed. That's very important. But they were being attacked, bombed from the air, 92 families totally obliterated from the population register, it doesn't matter. And yet you blame the victim, because Hamas was using these people as human shields, and therefore they have the right to kill them. And of course the occupier is claiming self-defense. They are defending themselves against their own victims. I've never heard this logic before in world history. Then, the structure and participants, the Palestinian-Jordanian delegation, as you know, now it's back again, the whole issue of the Jordanian option, the alternative homeland, the confederation, but it's a Jordanian issue. when they said no Palestinians from the PLO and no Palestinians from Jerusalem, that's precisely because they didn't want a national address for the Palestinians, a localized address, village leagues, communities, and so on, but not the right to self-determination and not Jerusalem. Again, there was a division of labor. I will skip a few things, but that the U.S. is in charge of the political process, but Europe and the Arabs are in charge of signing checks. So the decisions, political decisions, are up to the U.S. It's a monopoly. And the others have to work on nation building, because, you see, we have to prove that we deserve a state, even though it is a right enshrined in international law, the right to self-determination. And again, proof of merit. Even then, for the U.S. to participate directly in the talks, it had to get Israel's permission. They couldn't participate unless Israel invited them to participate or asked them to participate with their approval. So Israel positioned itself as a gatekeeper to the peace process. And the Europeans followed step. They always had to give them inducements and advance payments and rewards and so on to allow them to play a role. If you are the occupying power and you are the gatekeeper, what kind of peace process is this? Well, you exclude others. Procedurally, the phased approach, conflict management, open-ended process. You can look at all these documents I gave you. And, of course, the deal, we had to deal with administrative, technical, peripheral issues first, postpone the real issues, and get no guarantees on that. No mechanisms for arbitration, monitoring, and verification, although all negotiations should have those, even though I still believe negotiations between occupied and occupied are illegal. They violate the Fourth Geneva Convention, by the way. And it has to be done between equal parties, but when you have a situation of occupation where one party exercises total control over the others, any agreement will be illegal because it will be reached under duress and with undue influence and force. And then the whole issue of pocket and proceed. This is happening with things like the land swaps. There was never any agreement on a land swap, but somehow they decided that, yes, land swaps, because they want to keep the settlement blocks no matter what. All settlements are illegal, whether they are blocks or whether they are outposts or whether they are mobile homes or whatever. They are all illegal. So we never agreed to having settlement blocks as being legal or remaining. Now they talk about it as a foregone conclusion, or that there will be land swaps. It was very difficult to accept the 67 boundaries. Now we have to give away Jerusalem, the Jerusalem environment, Ariel, Gush Etzion, all these. So they pocket and proceed, including the issue of refugees, by the way. And the process is a process for its own sake. Now, using prolongation and stalling, it is the Dennis Ross logic, I call it. Well, so long as there's a process, God's in his heaven, all's well with the world. Let the two parties speak. And then Israel can do whatever it wants on the ground, which is an endless process. And it became an abstraction, it became a tool for Israeli power and expansionism and so on, and a cover for the occupation. So negotiations became an objective, not a tool to get somewhere. Now we are back at the beginning, as I said. I want to go through the... At one point, there was one point in which there was talk of 67 boundaries, two states. It started with George W. Bush and Clinton talking about two states, 60. It wasn't, by the way, Obama who was bashed by Israel for mentioning 67. It was Clinton and George Bush. It was George Bush, actually, who talked about 67 and the two states. You'll be surprised. And then now the cycle is completed. We're going back to all the issues of the functional approach, non-sovereign approach, gradual approach, and so on. With the Greenblatt, I just want to mention quickly... Uh, There are two things I cannot skip. The fact that we are not a demographic problem for Israel. Please do not accept this. We are a nation with our rights, with our history, with our culture, and we abide by international law. And I don't believe any other country in the world is allowed to discriminate against a people because it wants to maintain the ethnic or religious purity of its own entity at all. So we cannot be a demographic problem to scare the Israelis into giving us our little statelet or state minus, as they say. Now, they are busy superimposing Greater Israel on historical Palestine. Okay, what are the options if they destroy, and they are destroying the two-state solution? Is it the ongoing state of apartheid that exists? And of course, they wax hysterical when people describe them as being apartheid. Note what happened to Rima Khalaf, because now the UN is echoing the language of Israel at the behest of Netanyahu and Danny Danone and all these people who formulate that language. If this situation will continue, then it will run its course as an ongoing perpetual occupation, conflict, extremism. Or are we going to have a qualitative shift? Maybe we need to de-Zionize Israel rather than Zionize the Palestinians. I have to stop. Okay. I will talk later about what Greenblatt did, but I wouldn't hold my breath. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to meet you. Thank you.
Unfortunately, that is all the time we have this morning. You have been listening to Hanan Eshwari speaking at the conference of the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs.
One of these days, things ain't gonna change. One of these days.
Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update. Kind of warm here in New York City, and I commiserate with you if you have that problem where you are. This is a program that every week looks at our incomes, our debts, our jobs, what's coming down the road. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and now I bring whatever it is I've learned over that time to this program each week to present what's going on in the broad economic situation we all have to live with. Before jumping in, I need to make a few very short announcements. The first is that if you ever miss this program, we are archived by iHeartRadio.com. Letter I, then heart as in your chest, radio. iHeartRadio.com. Go there, look for Economic Update, and you can catch any program that you may have missed. We're very grateful to iHeartRadio for partnering with us in this way. Second, I want to remind you that if you would like to see this program as a television program in video form, please visit us at patreon.com. That's patreon.com/economic update. There you will be able to see this program as effectively a television program, and we would appreciate your giving that a look. And finally, as I announced last week, we are now represented in terms of my speaking around the country by a great outfit from California called speakoutnow.org. That's all one word, speakoutnow.org. You can go to their website and see me listed there. And if you're interested in pursuing a possible visit to your area, please get in touch with them via email at info@speakoutnow.org. All right, let's jump right in. The big item these last few days has been the health care struggles. The whole Senate had to postpone dealing with it because there's such tension, such disagreement, not only between Republicans and Democrats, but among both of them about what ought to be done. It is, after all, shameful that the United States, one of the richest countries in the world, is unable to provide decent medical insurance to its people the way literally all of the other advanced industrial countries have been doing for decades. It's also doubly shameful that we have the most expensive health care in the world, partly because of that first thing I said, because we don't have comprehensive government-managed or indeed government-run health care the way they do in so many other countries. So we spend almost twice what other countries do for our health care, that is, our doctors, our hospitals, our drugs, our medical devices, and the insurance to cover all of that. And that is being ripped off in our country in a way that no other country permits. Well, what's the fight about? Well, on the one hand, we have Obamacare, the health change that was passed during the Obama administration. The good news about that was it extended health insurance to millions of people who had been without it. And that's certainly a step in the right direction. It even went further by paying for a good part of that by taxing wealthy people and a few of the healthcare corporations raking in the big bucks. Well, that was more than enough to get the Republicans to turn against it. But the Obamacare also had flaws, failures, which the Republicans could and did take advantage of. And the biggest one goes right back to the monopoly arrangement of our medical industrial industries. The problem was Obamacare did nothing to prevent or stop private medical care companies, the doctors and the hospitals and the drug and medical device makers and the insurers, from either opting out of markets when they didn't make enough profit or jacking up their prices. There were some notorious examples that we all read about in the newspaper, so that many Americans were angry about the Obamacare, not because it extended coverage to poor people, which for sure there is mass support for, I'm happy to say, but rather because their premiums were going up faster than even before, and they felt correctly that they were being ripped off. Great, the GOP and Trump could use that, could say over and over again, it's a disaster, it's failing. That wasn't true, but it captured the anger of people facing ever higher prices to produce ever higher profits. So in come the Trump GOP folks. The first thing they do is propose to get rid of the taxes on rich people and even on the corporations, because, of course, that's always their first priority. And second, to reduce the coverage for poor people, since there wouldn't be the money coming in from the tax on the rich and the corporations, modest though that was. But that proved to be too much for the GOP moderates, they're called. They were getting screaming calls from their constituents who were telling them, if you cut out Obamacare, it's going to be even worse for us in these following ways. And then they explained what it means if you cut health insurance for all kinds of poor people, for all kinds of people who aren't normally poor but suffer a particular disease or suffer a cutback in employment. You see the picture. So here they are, the Democrats and Republicans, those who are in both parties worried about what will happen if you get rid of Obamacare and substitute the lame Republican alternative. But here's what upsets me, and I hope upsets you. Throughout all these debates, nobody questions the status quo of the medical industrial monopoly. That's right. The doctors and hospitals, the drug companies, the insurers, they struggle amongst themselves, but they present a common face to the rest of us. Pay up. Pay more than anywhere else in the world to give us higher profits than anywhere else in the world for people doing the work we do. As long as we don't question that, we will be struggling and choosing between one inadequate plan and another. The bottom line is the two political parties protect the medical industrial monopoly because they're afraid to confront them. Next update. The United States has one of the lowest minimum wages in the advanced industrial world. Another shameful reality. The World Economic Forum did a recent table that I find useful. They took the minimum wage, the cash money a worker gets at the bottom, minimum, and they subtracted from it the amount of taxes that worker has to pay on that minimum he or she earns. And then they ranked the countries. Where do workers get more and where do they get less in their minimum wage after taxes? The United States didn't show well, as you might imagine. So I'm going to give you a list now of the countries that pay more of a minimum wage after taxes than the United States. Just you can see that way where we rank in the world economic picture when it comes to how we treat those at the minimum wage. Here are the countries who pay more. Australia, Luxembourg, Belgium, Ireland, France, Netherlands, New Zealand, Germany, Canada, and the United Kingdom. That we fall below all of those, well, there's nothing I can say that would be adequate to what that's about. The next update has to do with a kind of straw in the wind. Two unions at opposite ends of the United States, one in California and the other one in Mississippi, are doing something that unions haven't done enough of, and I'm wondering whether these are straws in the wind. In the case of California, it's the workers at AT&T, the telephone company, who were given a contract which proposed, on the one hand, to give them an 11% increase over 4 years. That works out to about 2.5% a year, hardly a fortune. And remember, if you get 2.5% a year and prices go up 2.5% a year, which many people think they will over the next 4 years, you've got nothing in the way of an advance. That would be bad enough. But the 11% over 4 years was coupled by the company with an increase in how much the workers have to pay out of their own medical insurance. And indeed, the workers were now going to be asked to pay 29% of the cost of the medical insurance that comes with their job. In effect, that increase in what they have to pay for the same medical care they've been getting would take away the benefit of the wage increase, or most of it. In other words, they were offered next to nothing. And with the rising prices in this economy, it could literally have been negative over the next 4 years. The union and the company agreed to this contract, presented it to, I believe it's 17,000 workers at AT&T in California and I think also Nevada. And the workers have just recently rejected the contract as inadequate. It's very interesting because it shows that the workers understand there they are the bottom line in the end. And if they don't go along, everybody else has to scurry and come up with another solution. That's interesting that those workers had that sense to vote that way and to force a better deal to come down the pike. The second example is the United Auto Workers in Mississippi, which is culminating a 14 or 15 year effort to unionize a Nissan automobile plant in Mississippi. They're very hopeful. They have filed for an election within the next month, and that too may be a straw in the wind for the unionization. Remember, in the Great Depression, the American working class decided to join unions as a way to defend against the falling incomes and falling wages that a depression always means. In this catastrophe since 2008, the second worst collapse of capitalism in its history, workers have not yet made that decision. So it's an interesting question whether it's a straw in the wind that the auto workers in Mississippi may in fact lead the way to a resumption of that kind of response. My next short update, I wish it could be longer, takes me back to something I have done over the last year more than once, and that's to talk about the behavior, because it's important for economics, of the new Pope. He's not so new now, Pope Francis, but he continues to do remarkable things. And I want to talk about two of them that have economic impacts. The first has to do with a conference held in Rome from the 28th of June to the 1st of July, just passed, by the Confederation of Trade Unions in Italy. That's roughly the equivalent of the AFL-CIO here in the United States. It is the major trade union organization. It's already interesting that the Pope addresses them, as he has before. But I want to read to you a few of the sentences that come directly from that speech, which I read with enormous interest. He says, for example, "We must think," I'm quoting now from Pope Francis, "we must also think of a healthy culture of idleness, of knowing how to rest. This is not laziness. It is a human need. When I ask a man or woman with two or three children, 'Tell me, do you play with your children? Do you allow yourself this, quote-unquote, idleness?' 'Well, you know, when I go to work, they are still asleep, and when I return, they are already in bed.' When a worker says that," according to Pope Francis, here's his response: "This is inhuman. Along with work, there must also be other culture. Because a person is not only formed by labor, because we do not always work, and we must not work always. A good job is one that gives you time to be a human being," says the Pope. "And when the," I'm now quoting again, "and when the right to a fair pension is not always recognized, and not to all, then it is bad. A pension that is fair is neither too poor nor too rich. Golden pensions are no less an offense to labor than pensions that are too low." Wow. The Pope is against too much as well as too little. I wonder how Roman Catholics in the United States are going to digest, process, think about what their Pope is telling them. Let me go on with some of the other things he says. He talks explicitly about unions and what he thinks unions should do. "We believe the unions are prophetic." That's the word he uses. And here's what he means by such language: "The union risks losing its prophetic nature and becoming too similar to the institutions and powers that it should instead criticize." The words of Pope Francis. Here we go, more words. "The union, with the passing of time, has ended up resembling politics, or rather political parties, their language, their style. And instead, if this typical and diverse dimension is lacking, its action within businesses will lose strength and effectiveness. The union's movement has its great seasons when it is prophecy, when it helps not only to unmask the powerful who trample the rights of the most vulnerable workers, but who also defend the foreigner, the least, the discarded." Pope Francis is urging the unions to represent not only their members, but especially those who don't have work, who are discriminated against, who are the outsiders. "The union has to bring change. It's," quote, and now I'm quoting again, "it's like a watchman who guards and protects those who are inside the city of labor, but also guarding and protecting those who are outside the walls. It is not enough to protect only your members." Now, a couple of sentences that really need to be repeated. I don't have the time, but I want you to hear them at least once. Quote, Pope Francis, a couple of weeks ago, quote, "The capitalism of our time does not understand the value of the trade union, because it has forgotten the social nature of the economy, of the business. This is one of the greatest sins." Pope Francis is really clear, and his support for the union as a central part of a good society ought to make people sit up and think about what he's saying. But to be fair, the Pope also does things that raise more than a few eyebrows. I want to bring one of those, because of its economic content, to your attention. He made a decision that in a letter to bishops, bread can be low gluten. Excuse me. It cannot be. Low gluten or gluten-free bread cannot be used in church ceremonies. However, genetically modified wheat and other materials in the bread is okay. Everything is mixed in this world, and that applies to all the churches, too. The final short update for today is a shout-out, of approval. And this one goes to the city of Seattle. Why? Because in recent days, the city of Seattle's city council, its legislative body, has taken a remarkable step. It has passed a bill unanimously and with the enthusiastic support of the mayor of Seattle, both the past mayor and the sitting mayor. And this bill provides for an income tax to be applied to residents of Seattle. 2.25% on all income over $250,000 for an individual or over $500,000 per year for a married couple who file together. Let me stop and let that sink in. The city of Seattle has decided to tax its wealthiest citizens. 9-0 was the vote of the city council to do this. So it's not only happening in Seattle, it's happening unanimously and enthusiastically. What is this about? The state of Washington, where Seattle is located, is notorious across the 50 states for having one of the most regressive tax structures in the country. What does that mean? Regressive taxes, that's simply a term, means a tax that makes no effort to take account of the person's ability to pay who's required to pay the tax. In other words, think of a sales tax. If everybody who buys a shirt for $50 has to pay the same $5 tax or whatever it might be, then that's a tax that makes no effort to discriminate. Rockefeller or Bill Gates or Warren Buffett buys the shirt, pays the same tax as does a person on welfare who buys the shirt. We have in the United States many such regressive taxes. Washington relies on regressive taxes. It doesn't have an income tax. Income taxes have often, not always, but have often been progressive. That is, the rate of tax you pay goes up with the higher income you may be earning. So people who earn at the top pay a higher rate than people who earn at the bottom. That's a progressive tax. In other words, the tax you're asked to pay takes account of your ability to pay. Okay, so what the City Council of Seattle is doing is saying, we're not happy living in a state that taxes people without regard to their ability to pay. We believe that to be fundamentally unjust and unfair, which is what many members of the City Council said in their comments about this decision they've reached. We would like to correct the unfairly regressive structure of taxes in Seattle by having a income tax, a progressive income tax, because the rate below $250,000 a year is zero, and the rate above $250,000 a year is 2.25%. That's a progressive income tax. For those of you who may not know it, when the progressive income tax for the country as a whole was passed back in 1910, over 100 years ago, it too was an income tax that exempted the vast majority of Americans from any tax on their income and was only intended to be a tax on those at the top. Over the last 100 years, those at the top worked very hard to use their money to move the burden of taxation, of income taxation, off of themselves and on to the middle class, which the middle class permitted them to do, since the middle class are the vast majority, and those above who were taxed in 1910 were a tiny minority. It was clear that the way the minority got the middle class to buy it was to buy the politicians, so it was difficult, or if not impossible, to push against it. We'll see what the future holds in Seattle if the income tax passes. But of course, immediately a cry went up from the Republicans, from the business community, from all those who stand to lose. And they are going to fight it in court, and they're going to make propaganda against it. They've already begun to do that. So it will be a fight. The people in Seattle who've pushed for this know it. But a unanimous city council and a supportive mayor, which are now settled matters, indicate that the majority of people in Seattle want this, which is one major reason why all of these politicians support it. And that means the courts will be under all kinds of pressure to go along with this change, to allow the sovereignty of the city of Seattle, the major urban area in the state of Washington, to be played out in this way that the majority of people want. It is, in a way, an enormous step. One of the things it ought to do is to inspire, motivate, to create an incentive to cities and towns across the United States, many of whom live in, are situated in states without the restrictive laws that Washington has about such things. In other words, it's easier in other states to pass such a law, to get such a law effective in the society. And think how it would change. The city of Seattle estimates that the tax would raise about $140 million a year, allowing that city to improve its schools, its parks, to relieve the burden of taxation on those least able to pay, to make the city of Seattle a much better place than it is now. And what? And how? By taking 2.25% of the money over $250,000 that a person earns, or over $500,000. A minimal burden on those at the top for a maximum benefit for the vast majority of Seattle residents. In fact, including those at the top who will also get benefits from a better school system, a better park system, and a less divided by income community. The question is whether this fight will be won or lost. But our hats must go off to the people and to the city council and to the mayor of Seattle, who've taken an important step in correcting a fundamentally unjust tax system, not only in Seattle and Washington, but in many other parts of the United States as well. We've come to the end of the first half of this program. Please stay with us in the second half. We're going to deal with some other issues of interest to you. This is a program that is designed to have you get, as much as I can do it, an insight into the current economic shifts and struggles, not only to inform you, but also to give you ammunition to make the kinds of changes the country needs. Thank you very much for listening. Stay with us. We will be right back.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Yes, and how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. Yes, and how many years can a mountain exist before it is washed to the sea? Yes, and how many years can some people exist before they're allowed to be free? Yes, and how many times can a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. Yes, and how many times must a man look up before he can see the sky? Yes, and how many ears must one man have before he can hear people cry? Yes, and how many deaths will it take till he knows that too many people have died? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
Welcome back, friends, to the second half of today's economic update. Before jumping into the analyses of some bigger topics that need a bit more time each than I can devote to the topics done in the first half, I want to remind you that we maintain two websites whose basic purpose is to enable us to partner with you. The first one is democracyatwork.info. That's all one word, democracyatwork.info. And the second one is rdwolf.com. rdwolf.com. Both of these websites are available to you without any charge 24/7. They enable you to communicate with us what you would like us to cover, not cover, what's pleasing, what's displeasing to you about what we're doing. We read every single one, and we use your comments and suggestions in designing the programs week after week. The two websites also allow you to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. They allow you to see what we post on YouTube and elsewhere. They are also very important places where we post work that we do. There's a blog that has all kinds of important information, articles, snippets of information that anyone interested in the economy of the United States, in changing it, in the worker co-op project that is so important to us, all of that information is gathered all the time. You will see fascinating articles, videos, audio recordings. When I do a media event, for example, I make a comment on the Tom Hartman show on a regular basis. Those are posted so you can see them. These are repositories for information, for video, audio, and written materials. Use it. That's why we put it up there. Partner with us. Help it reach still other audiences. That's a way of working with us to make this program even more useful to more people than it already is. And I have great hopes that in the next few weeks I will be making announcements of our reaching yet more people across the United States. Okay, let's turn then to some of the larger topics. I'm going to do something slightly unusual for me. I'm going to comment about individuals. And in this case, the leaders of the G20. They just had a big meeting. You may have read about it in the newspapers or seen it elsewhere on the media. The 20 arguably richest or most influential in some sense countries in the world have been getting together since 1999. This was their 12th meeting, particularly the 12th of the leaders, so that Donald Trump went, Vladimir Putin of Russia went, and Angela Merkel of Germany went, and so on. They gathered in Hamburg, Germany. Germany was the host. And they were there to discuss whatever issues they felt, particularly economic issues, but not only, were important. So they discussed world trade. They discussed climate change and how to deal with it. They discussed immigration and so on. There's been plenty of reporting on what they discussed, not so much on the programs of austerity that every single one of them has imposed on their people, whether it's the Republicans and Democrats in this country or Merkel in Germany or fill in the blank. They didn't discuss that so much. That's just an assumption that they all feel they ought to do. And it's something which makes the mass of the world suffer. That's not what I'm talking about today. I want to bring you to an attention on the kinds of people that are leaders of the 20 richest countries meeting last week in Hamburg. Because this is a collection of leaders that tells you something, perhaps something scary, about where we are in the world. So I won't say much about who we sent from the United States. That speaks for itself, and you kind of all understand what that quality of leadership is. So let me begin, rather, with the host, Angela Merkel, who's pretty popular these days with people. Well, I don't want to puncture the balloon. Well, to be honest, maybe a bit. So let me tell you about a meeting at the Parliament of Germany literally days before these leaders gathered. Mrs. Merkel is the head of a coalition of two parties, the Christian Democratic Union and the Christian Social Union, two clearly very Christian parties. They had a meeting. And they had a meeting to decide how they would vote on a bill working its way through the upper and lower house of the German parliament. That bill was to legalize same-sex marriage, something which is happening all over the world and has happened in Germany now, too. The two Christian parties voted against the legalization of same-sex marriage. Angela Merkel, as a member of those parties, also did, and made public that she did so. For a whole host of reasons, a majority of the members of both houses in Germany disagreed with Angela Merkel and with many in the Christian parties. And so same-sex marriage was legalized. But you have to wonder about a leader of a country claiming to be the modern leader type who in her own political life functions that way. Representing Japan was Mr. Abe. He has just lost a major election in Tokyo and is accused of levels of corruption that are genuinely staggering. His last name is spelled A-B-E, and so the joke in Japan is he's not honest A-B-E, like our Abraham Lincoln. He's dishonest A-B-E. Then we have France's Macron, or as his critics in France like to say, Macaroon. He is only the president of France because the leading conservative was up to his eyeballs in levels of corruption that destroyed his candidacy. So Mr. Macron slithered in. He seems to be some kind of former socialist since he got into a government position thanks to the Socialist Party led by François Hollande. But his first acts were to appoint a conservative prime minister and to support that conservative prime minister in lowering taxes on the rich. I'll have more to say about Mr. Macron. Then we have Mr. Temer of Brazil, whose level of corruption, accused and already demonstrated, is literally off the charts. We have Mr. Zuma from South Africa, who gets the same. Mr. Nieto from Mexico, likewise. We have a level of people with crippling deficits. This system puts them in the position of leadership. Well, nothing would further summarize this than to give you a famous German quote. In German, it goes, Fett schwimmt oben. The English translation, the fat, as in a soup, or the scum, as in a pond, rises to the top. My next discussion has to do with the city of Detroit that I have discussed with you in the past. Detroit, the largest bankrupt city in American history, a catastrophe of unspeakable dimensions. I will summarize again, because we've done it in the past, simply the basics. In the 1960s and 70s, it was the picture city of modern capitalism, the automobile center, the place to which American presidents brought foreign visitors to see how capitalism worked. Three huge automobile companies, huge job stories, good pay won by the United Auto Workers, then arguably the biggest and most powerful union, or certainly one of them, here in the United States. A city that had managed not only to attract, but to provide decent jobs to African Americans when that had been a rarity in American history. They, too, got to be UAW workers, earning decent incomes, putting their kids to college, and all the rest. Population just shy of 2 million people. And here we are, a decade or two into the 21st century, 40, 50 years later, what have we got? A city that is one of the poorest in the United States. A city that drove out of itself more than half its population. Today, the population of Detroit is under 700,000 people, down from nearly 2 million. Those people left because there was no work. And there was no work because Ford, Chrysler, and General Motors decided they could make more profits, that's it, by moving somewhere else where they could pay workers much less. First to the American South, and then to Canada and Mexico, and now to China and India, leaving behind a city of disaster. High murder rates, high abandoned housing rates. Unbelievable story. 40, 50 years during which the mayors and the governors and the presidents, Republicans and Democrats alike, stood there looking at this long-term decay and doing nothing to stop it, let alone to reverse it, until finally total bankruptcy and a devastated city. That's the old story. In the last few years, there's been a lot of publicity, a really lot of it, speaking about Detroit's renaissance, Detroit's coming back. And I want to talk to you about that. There's something to it. There are buildings going up in the business district, in the Midtown area, restaurants, office towers. Something is going on. A great deal of it has to do with a man named Dan Gilbert. He's the owner-operator of Quicken Loans. He owns the basketball team, the Cleveland Cavaliers. He's a millionaire or billionaire. What difference really does that make? He owns over 90 buildings in the business district. He is bringing it back. And so there is a recovery of sorts. But it is like the recovery of the American economy since 2008. It's a recovery for the few. Let me remind you. 60% of the children of Detroit today continue to live in poverty, right? 40% of residents live below the official poverty line. So what is Detroit becoming? It's continuing to be an emblem of the United States. From the 1970s to 2010, let's say, it was an emblem of decline and decay. Now it is a different emblem. It's an emblem of the United States' reconstitution as a place in which there are glitzy, comfortable, wealthy enclaves, they're called in other parts of the world. Little protected areas, and I mean protected by how the roads are run, how the police are deployed, where the building codes go, a glitzy center and a vast, impoverished hinterland. That's what Detroit is becoming. That's what the recovery of Detroit is. It's being reorganized into a rich, comfortable, glitzy center and a vast sea of impoverished, excluded others. And it isn't just Detroit for which that is the story that we tell. The next update, which deserves some attention, has to do with something that happened over the last few weeks in San Diego, California. And it has to do with a little beer company. It's called Modern Times Beer, a company founded only in 2013, brewery that makes beer, craft beer, good quality beer, currently employs about 118 people and produces over 40,000 barrels of beer per year. That's not why I'm talking about it. I'm talking about it because of what the owner-operator who started the beer did this last week. His name is Jacob McKeon, M-C-K-E-A-N. And he's a remarkable fellow for two reasons that I want to bring to your attention. I'm not so interested in the fact that he successfully built a beer business. Others have done that, but he gets some approval for that, but that's not my interest. And he isn't new in what I'm about to tell you. But he takes it further than others have, and that's what I'm after. What did he do? A couple of Fridays ago, he announced that he's converting his business into a ESOP, E-S-O-P, which stands for Employee Stock Ownership Plan. He's basically giving his workers, those 118, a 30% ownership of the company in which they work. They are going together, if you add up what each one gets, they're going to own 30% of the company. The goal is for them eventually to own 100% of the company. That's what the current owner is planning to do. He believes it's in the best interests of San Diego, of beer production, of those 118, and of himself as an entrepreneur, that be the future of his company, Modern Times Beer. So first, let's look at this. Is this unique? Is he weird? No. I'm going to give you the names of three other companies that have done that. The Deschutes Beer Company of Bend, Oregon. The New Belgium Beer Company of Fort Collins, Colorado. And Harpoon Brewing of Boston. They are already employee-owned, to varying degrees, companies. Wow. There are others. There are others. So this is not unique. So why am I focusing on it? Well, first of all, I want to make sure that everybody understands what an ESOP is, because we're having more and more of them in the United States. That's when a company takes the ownership and transfers it from the family that may have started it, the individual who may have started it, other shareholders outside who may own pieces of it and moves that ownership one way or another by buying out the old people, by issuing new stocks. There's various ways of doing it, but they're basically transferring ownership to the workers themselves. One of the goals of Mr. McKeon are best expressed by him. And since he gave an interview recently that I found, I want to read it to you. Here we go. This is Mr. McKeon explaining why he did what he did. One way I pledge to keep this industry awesome is by never selling my brewery to big beer. Big beer means, you know, Budweiser, any of the other monsters. Continuing with Mr. McKeon, there will likely come a time when I'm tired of carrying the weight of so much responsibility as the owner-operator of Modern Times Beer. But when that time comes, I'm not going to screw the people who made my success possible in the first place. I want to read that to you again. Quote, I'm not going to screw the people who made my success possible in the first place. That would be an unethical choice I could never be proud of. I owe a tremendous debt of gratitude to everyone in this industry. And when it comes time for me to do something else, I refuse to throw a hand grenade over my shoulder on my way out the door. Oh, goodness. An employer, an entrepreneur who understands the gratitude he owes to his workers, to the community in which he developed this industry, to the countless helping hands, large and small, that all of those people, employees and citizens, gave to his company. He doesn't want to throw a hand grenade on his way out the door. Let me continue reading from Mr. McKeon. I've certainly given this a great deal of thought. What I learned is that if employees are not passionate about what the company makes and how it operates, they won't see themselves as having a future in it. Even a 100% ESOP, let me interject, that's a company where 100% of the ownership is in the hands of the employees. It does not have to offer any meaningful governance or management role to employees. What is he saying? He is saying that even if the workers own 100%, they can continue to live and work as workers. In other words, they don't act on their ownership. They don't use their ownership to change how the enterprise actually works. The consequence of not giving employees governance and control, Mr. McKeon goes on to say, is the following, and again I quote, if you do that, the company's owners aren't invested in the company's direction. That's a formula for a bad culture. It can lead to selling the company to big beer. We plan to do the opposite. And by that he means they're going to take economic ownership, what ESOPs are when workers become owners, and they're going to use the ownership to do something very different, very important, and very additional. And that is to become a company that is not just owned by the workers, but is run by the workers. It's not workers who are stock owners, but give the role of running the company to a board of directors, other people, not themselves workers. No, no, no. What Mr. McKeon is talking about is making the workers not only the owners, but here it comes, the operators, the directors. They won't name other people to be directors. They're going to make themselves the directors. You know why? Because, as he puts it, it's ethical. It makes the company more successful. And obviously, it increases the likelihood that the company will stay where these workers are rather than sell out to somebody else, destroying jobs, damaging the community, if and when the company you sell to decides to leave to make more money elsewhere, sort of like the car companies in Detroit did
because they were never run by their workers. Mr. McKean is recognizing something that is fundamental to the problems of the American capitalist economy. Most industries and most enterprises don't have someone like Jacob McKean. Too bad for them. Their culture isn't good, the way he says. They do sell out quickly and often to people who will move the factory out of the country, to people who will move the office out of the state, to people who will go where the profits are higher rather than taking account of the profits, but alongside the lives of the people, the workers and the surrounding community that are effective. The way to change that is not to pass a law that corporations will evade. It's not a regulation. It's a change of the structure of the enterprise to make the enterprise a place where those who work in it own it and direct it, and where the decisions they make have to be made together with the decisions coming from the residential communities that are affected by the company's decisions. The community's decisions affect the company. The company's decisions affect the residential community. So they need to be together in making decisions. Each one has to have veto power over the other one, because they have to work out things that are good for the people as workers and for the people as residents in a community. If you don't do that, your democracy isn't real. And if you don't do that, you have all the bad consequences that Mr. Jacob McKean, a successful entrepreneur, figures out for himself and announces to the world. He puts his money where his mouth is. And the 118 workers in San Diego have launched themselves, with his help, on a project not just to become the owners and thereby much more secure in their jobs, but to do with that ownership the transformation of their daily lives. They will all become not just workers in a beer factory, but also the designers, the directors, the decision makers on how to build that business, how to build the relationships with the communities where they live. They're in a position to change the economic system, to go beyond capitalism in a practical way. And beyond capitalism is not an abstraction. It's a simple idea. End the arrangement where a minority of people are the employers and the majority of the people are the employees, such that the minority makes all the key decisions and the majority has to make do and live with the results of decisions from which they are excluded. That's what Mr. McKean wants to put aside. And I am proud and pleased to take my hat off and to say, wow, there goes the kind of on-the-ground, practical, moving beyond the capitalist system that is the hope of the future of an economy in this country that has shown itself to be a vehicle for those at the top, those Renaissance folks in Detroit, while it leaves the mass of the people to live with the failures, with the destruction that capitalism has wreaked in so many parts of the United States and beyond. We've come to the end of this program. I want to thank you for being with us. I want to remind you that the biggest goal of this program is to partner with you in getting this message, these ideas, these understandings out to a larger population. I want to thank truthout.org, that remarkable independent source of news and information that has partnered with us for years. I look forward to speaking with you again next week.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Nolan Higdon. On today's program, we will discuss Islam and journalism in America. We'll be joined by our guest, Manar Mahawish of Mint Press News. Please stay with us. It's a dirty game, maintain my reign for capital gain. But my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. When our commodities or cars that turn the global economy, we're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring. An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces, slavery for a mighty dollar bill. We won.
Crimes perpetrated by the criminal minds, political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host Desiree McSwain and Dr. Nicholas Baham III. Later on, we'll be joined by our special correspondent, Amy Casey. And it's nice. We got the whole crew back together again in Hayward. We are broadcasting live from CSU East Bay and looking for a show about Islam journalism, which is becoming more and more relevant given Trump's Muslim ban as well as this war on journalism. You excited to talk about these things, Desiree?
Totally.
I can tell. People missed you. They're happy you're back.
Yay. That's great.
All right. So, Amy, why don't you tell us who's on the show today?
Thank you, Nolan. Greetings, listeners. I am Amy Casey with the Media Freedom Foundation. Today's guest, Manar Mahawish of Mint Press News. Manar Mahawish is founder, CEO, and editor-in-chief of Mint Press News, a watchdog journalism organization exposing the link between special interest groups and big money with policies at home and war abroad. Mahawish is also a regular speaker on responsible journalism, sexism, neoconservatism within the media and journalism startups. She is also former TV host and producer of Behind the Headline on Free Speech TV that aired in 2016. She started her career as an independent multimedia journalist covering Midwest and national politics while focusing on civil liberties and social justice issues, posting her reporting and exclusive interviews on her blog, Mint Press, which she later turned into Mint Press into the global news source it is today. In 2009, Mahawish also became the first American woman to wear the hijab to anchor and report the news in American media. Mahawish is also a wife and mother of a 7-year-old boy, juggling her duties as a CEO and motherly tasks successfully as supermom.
All right, Manar, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. If you wouldn't mind, could you give our listeners a little background on Mint Press News, like how long it's been around, where they can access it, and those sorts of things?
Absolutely. Well, our website is mintpressnews.com, and we launched in 2012. So we're just a few years old here. And we're part of the new media, independent media, I would say, revival or revolution, as we'd like to call it. And part of our purpose is to combat, the real fake news that the mainstream and corporate media spew every single day. It's the junk food news, junk food headlines that we're inundated day in and day out. Part of our mission is to expose the driving factors of war, imperialism abroad, and then also what are the driving factors and the special interest groups that influence politics at home as well that are, quashing our civil liberties and affecting our democracy. And so we are on Facebook, we are on YouTube, and we are on Twitter. And, since we've launched, we've been able to reach pretty steadily about 2 million unique visitors per month. And so, and most of that has been through organic growth. And I think it's mostly because our success has, you know, we can point a lot of our success and organic growth to the fact that most Americans, I mean, over 70% now, I think the most recent Gallup poll, I think it's even higher than that, don't trust the corporate media anymore. So people are very, very thirsty for real, honest reporting on the issues that the corporate media doesn't talk about. I know there's a huge backlash right now from the corporate media. Anything that challenges them, they label it as fake news. Well, they are the real fake news. And so we're trying to bring back and restore the fourth estate.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. I wanted to get into that term with you. There's kind of been this weird bedfellows that have been created in the Trump era. Because on the one hand, Trump is attacking a lot of these corporate news agencies, calling them fake news, which I would say is correct. But he's calling them fake. Yeah, he's calling them fake news because they criticize him, which I see as part of like this larger war on journalism, which is any journalist who criticizes Trump is somehow fake news, whether corporate or independent. So I'm wondering, you know, how do you see that being this independent journalist, given the contemporary context of the relationship between politicians and the media?
You know, it's an interesting time in Trump land, because I would say that we agree with Trump that, you know, the corporate media is fake news. But we have to be really careful. And it's interesting because there is this trend where anything that Trump says, you know, people on the left are going to call him a psychopath or narcissistic or whatever. And so they've kind of jumped on this bandwagon of kind of attacking his attack on the media. But we have to be a little fair here and say that, you know, yeah, his criticism does come from the fact that the media is criticizing him. But that is the one area that I think that we can all agree that the corporate media is fake news. But what's really upsetting is that you're seeing people on the left, you know, all of a sudden they're citing the corporate media. They're leaning towards this, you know, the Hillary Clinton, CNN media, and other organizations like the New York Times and the Associated Press to criticize Trump. So all of a sudden you have like this new leftist movement who's like joining the corporate media and criticizing Trump and pushing kind of this Russia phobia and like, you know, the bromance between Putin and Trump. I hope that makes sense. But we have to give Trump just a tiny bit of credit for making this one assertion that the corporate media is fake news. And so I think that as an independent journalist, I think that that's the one area that we can agree with Trump on.
Yeah, I think it makes absolute sense. Me and Nick are very familiar with bromances, so that's true.
Manara, this is Desiree. First, I just wanted to agree with what you just said, but then I also wanted to get your perspective on how people may view or how you view Trump's relationship with the media, specifically CNN, and who he's calling fake news now. At the beginning of election, when he was getting all the spotlight, he was on every network, like nonstop, and almost getting like this huge free publicity stunt. And then fast forward to now, he's attacking the media and him are in a battle. And it's almost like, do you see this as like, it was set up this way? Do you think that it was kind of just the consequence of people turning on the media? And so Trump wanted to kind of distance himself from people saying that the media interfered with the election. How do you view that?
Well, I think it's all theatrical, you know, just like the elections were just one big, you know, circus. I think this whole media frenzy over Trump is one media, you know, one big media circus as well. If the corporate media wanted to truly and truly, truly, truly criticize Trump, they would go after the deep state. They would go after his neocolonial foreign policy. They would go after, you know, the rise of the, you know, the far right and so forth. But they're not. They're going after, like, his daughter, Ivanka. He's going after, like, his relationships. And they're going after his, you know, relationship or, you know, his supposed alleged bromance with Putin. But there's, like, no mention within the corporate media. And here's, this is my criticism of, you know, CNN is, you know, obviously they're not going after his policies in Syria or his policy for expanding the war in Afghanistan or the war in Iraq. They're not going after those policies that people should probably know about. So it's all theatrics, in my opinion, and from what I'm seeing. And when it comes to CNN, you know, the coverage that's coming out of CNN, obviously CNN is a major perpetrator of fake news. And we now have, you know, leaked video that had come out, I think it was last week, of a CNN producer saying that this whole Russia-phobia and, like, this romance between Trump and Putin is, like, you know, just good for ratings. It's fake. There's no evidence of any election hacking by the Russians and so forth. And so they're pushing out these narratives to demonize and push this, you know, Russia-phobic narrative that supports, of course, the Democratic Party and their foreign policies and the neocons. But, you know, we really have to be kind of critical of both. And although I do agree with that one aspect of Trump calling the corporate media fake news, I mean, both of them are wrong from that perspective.
Mm-hmm. So when it occurs to me, too, that while we have this fake news coming out of CNN, on the one hand, yeah, it is used to support the Democratic Party. But I think it's also part of, like, a larger process of hurting journalists, right? Because this continues to just give people a reason to lack faith in journalism. And I'm wondering how you see mm-hmm. that affect the type of work you do, where, you know, increasingly a lot of people don't see the difference between corporate and independent journalists. And so, you know, they see journalism having these problems and they think all journalists are the problem. And Trump certainly has echoed that narrative with his recent tweets and et cetera. So I'm wondering, how do you see that as affecting you and the work you do?
Well, I meet everyday average people. I mean, you know, the trust in journalism in general has gone down so much. I mean, what you're saying is absolutely correct. People just don't trust the media, and it is not because of the work we're doing. You know, we're reaching a very specific demographic and audience, people who are really, you know, smarter and wiser. You know, they've made the decision already that the corporate media is fake news, and they're looking for an alternative. But the average American doesn't, you know, they don't have the, you know, the, how do I say this? Like, they don't have the, maybe the, as much critical thinking skills to kind of jump out of that, you know, paradox of, you know, corporate media. So they kind of, you know, blend all of journalism and all of journalists together because of what they see from CNN. And so this has obviously hurt independent journalists because, like, you know, we're trying to send a message that challenges the mainstream, that challenges the corporate media, but the damage seems to be already done, that journalism cannot, you know, journalists cannot be trusted. They all have some sort of agenda, you know, as Trump would put it, or the way CNN has made themselves out to appear. So they've really ruined it for everybody. But I think it's also a really important time to hang on to that and to grab on to those people who are really frustrated with the media. Now, they may be really skeptical and critical, and maybe they don't trust the media. Maybe they don't even want to, you know, even read the corporate media. Maybe they don't even want to get involved, because I hear this a lot when I give presentations. They're like, you know, I don't even trust the media. It's too depressing. You know, everybody has their own agenda. Everyone's so opinionated. I don't even know how to differentiate fact from fiction anymore. I mean, I hear this. I'm sure you guys hear this all the time, too. And so I think, you know, even though it's tough to get those people on board, it's also an opportunity for us to kind of reach out to them and sit down with them and talk to them about these kind of differences so that they can be able to see and differentiate between fake news and real news.
Well, I'm glad you brought that point up as well. It's something that I've struggled with, too, is how to reach out to other groups in this age of, like, divisive politics and demonizing other people. How do you sort of tap into that human element that exists in every person to try and reach out to say, like, maybe you can check out something at Mint Press, you know, look at it, see what it says, evaluate it, and potentially this may change your views. I mean, how have you felt, like, how successful have you been at doing that?
You know, one thing that, you know, I'll share my personal experience, you know, as a Muslim, as a hijab woman, as a young woman, journalists and female journalists in the U.S. with the rise of, you know, all this Islamophobia, I've had to put myself in really uncomfortable positions, sometimes in areas in the state of Minnesota where I'm from. For example, like in Michelle Bachmann districts, in neo-Nazi district areas, and give presentations to people that would normally would never listen to me. But I've, you know, inserted myself into those situations and kind of presented, because I do a lot of presentations at universities and local events, and I've presented the news and politics in a way that kind of overlooks party lines, and I think that's really, really important, and kind of
sends a message of unity and peace, and that there is a bigger, deeper state that's trying to divide us. And that always seems to work. I mean, I don't think I've ever failed in sending that message of peace and unity from that perspective. You know, it really takes away, you know, people get really uncomfortable at the very beginning when they start hearing these things. But it really kind of takes away all those uncomfortable feelings, and they start to open up their heart and realize that, you know, we're actually a lot more similar. So from my experience, even though, you know, my journalism has nothing to do with my religion, you know, I do wear hijab. And so when people see me, they have those kind of ideas because of the rise of Islamophobia. And so before I can even talk to them about war, before I can even talk to them about all these issues, I have to kind of break those barriers and those shackles. And I've been really successful in doing that in my state and in presentations I've given across the country. And it's uncomfortable. It's hard, but it is doable. And again, that's just from my perspective and my experience.
Minar, can you share your experience being a Muslim woman, like you said, being a Muslim and a woman in the time of the 9/11 era all the way up till now? Do you see this as like the rise in kind of like the 9/11 2.0, where we have the super drived hate against Islam and Islamophobia, but then with Trump kind of heading this movement, he's also taken a special jab at women specifically. So what's your experience with that then and now?
Well, it's always been very tough being a woman in general, so that definitely has not changed. But I definitely agree with you in the way you described it as like a, you know, a post 9/11 2.0 kind of era. I feel like, and maybe it's because I was a lot younger at the time, but I feel like after 9/11, it was easier to be Muslim. You know, it was tough at the time. I mean, I had received discrimination. You know, people in my classroom would tell me that I was related to Osama bin Laden. You know, I was pretty young. I was like in the junior high going into high school when 9/11 happened. And so definitely faced that discrimination. But I also had this hope, you know, inside of me that, you know, I'm going to change perspectives and I'm going to break barriers. That's part of the reason why I became a journalist, is because of, you know, just like every other person in this country, I was inundated with the fear-mongering, with the Islamophobia, with the same messages and, you know, extreme propaganda that all Muslims are bad and Islam is a jihadist religion that's out to kill and destroy the world. I mean, all of these things are absolutely ridiculous, and it's obviously driven by fear, and it's used to justify, of course, our ever-growing war machine across the Middle East and Africa and predominantly Muslim nations. And so I made the connection at a very young age that there was a deeper meaning behind this propaganda. And so that's why I chose to become a journalist and wanted to expose the military-industrial complex for what it was. I wanted to expose that Islamophobia industry. And from there, I went on to work in independent journalism and, you know, do my own work and so forth. And I actually didn't wear hijab at the time, but later on I decided to wear hijab. And then I soon actually became the first American, you know, woman to wear the hijab to anchor and report the news in American media. And so that was a very, very big deal. And at the time, many Muslims wouldn't go into journalism. I would go and speak, and I was like, you know, we need to rise up and, like, represent ourselves in a better way, especially the woman, because there was this idea based from this propaganda that women, especially Muslim women, were oppressed. They couldn't think for themselves. They weren't powerful. They weren't independent. They weren't intelligent. And so this was obviously goes against, you know, reality. And so I would try to kind of gather Muslim women, like, we have to rise up and, you know, become part of the political atmosphere, become, you know, part of the media industry so that we can change perspectives. But they were so scared because they were let down by the media. And I just didn't allow that to happen. Failure was not an option in my perspective and in my heart. And so at that time, I had that hope, and that, you know, the fact that I saw so many people let down by the media, that actually gave me more strength to carry on and continue. And things were getting really better for a while. But the Islamophobia industry has only grown. I believe it's worth over $3 million per year. We have special interest groups that, like, directly profit from war, who want to link, you know, Muslims to the war on terror and jihadis and ISIS and all of these things, when most of these terrorists are being funded by our own deep state and our intelligence community. And so, you know, we just, you know, it's just been a struggle to be able to expose those things, but it's also given, you know, rise and a bigger platform for people like myself to speak up and to, you know, bring that unity back to where it needs to be. And that was kind of my long answer. I apologize for going off the top, but it has definitely been an interesting journey to get to the point where we are today.
We are talking to Mint Press CEO and supermom, Manar Mahawish, and we're going to take a short musical break before, and when we come back, we're going to talk about what is Mint Press News covering now, and what does Manar think about Trump's Muslim ban, as it's called. So we'll be back after this short musical break. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. We are talking to Manar Mahawish of Mint Press News. I am in studio with Amy Casey, Desiree McSwain, and Dr. Nicholas Baham III. Manar, before we took a break, I said I wanted to talk a little bit about what are the type of stories or what stories is Mint Press covering right now that our listeners can check out on your website?
Well, this week we've been kind of covering some of the issues taking place with this Russia phobia bromance connection between Trump and Putin. As you know, Putin and Trump are meeting today. I believe they actually met in the last hour or so. And so one of the major stories that we're covering is the fact that CNN and the New York Times and the Associated Press have retracted the claim that 17 U.S. intelligence agencies agree that Russia hacked U.S. elections. And then on top of that, in the past week, we've seen CNN producers, you know, under leaked video, admit that the whole Russia connection with the elections is like a big hoax. It's basically fake news, and they just have been pushing that narrative for ratings. And so that's one major story that we've been covering for the last week and a half to 2 weeks. Another story that we're covering is India being being pulled out of BRICS. I mean, India is still part of the BRICS coalition, but Israel and the United States are kind of trying to charm India into pulling out of BRICS through arms, massive, massive arms sales. And so those are two of the big stories that we're covering this week, and they're both on our website.
Yeah, I know this from working at Project Censored for years. You eventually get a reputation as a place that people can trust, people who want information out that they can't get out elsewhere. And I'm wondering, Mint Press has been around now for just about 5 years. Have you experienced that? Do you have folks coming to you with story ideas? Are you starting to get a reputation? I mean, I know you have one with us, but are you getting a reputation with other groups as well as somewhere people can go to get information out that is not reported elsewhere?
Absolutely. I mentioned this at the very beginning. Part of our growth has been just tremendous, you know, growth through organic readership. you know, for not having any sort of marketing budget, you know, because we're such a small organization, you know, we've been able to reach about 2 million readers per month, unique visitors per month, pretty steadily over the course of the last 2.5 years since we've, you know, grown and so forth. And so our growth has been tremendous from that perspective. And we have contributors, analysts, and journalists, and investigative journalists who work for a multitude of organizations that reach out to us constantly, who are pitching stories. And we've built a lot of great partnerships. And one is actually with Project Censored and other news organizations. And so, you know, part of that, too, is not because we've had an easy time growing. It's because we've had a challenging time growing. And I think that's where a lot of news organizations kind of get it wrong is, you know, you have to take a stance and challenge certain stories and be okay with the backlash. And so that's kind of what we've done is we've been okay challenging war narratives. We've been okay challenging, you know, certain coverage issues that even alternative, some alternative media organizations won't even touch, like Syria or Libya, or what, you know, what's happening with those conflicts. And so, you know, that's also been attributed to a lot of our growth and building kind of the respect within the community is that we're going to get a lot of backlash, but that's okay because we know we're doing the right thing. And I think that's all that matters at the end of the day.
Well, I kind of want to talk about both the backlash you're receiving as well as the suffering and fear you're seeing in light of the Supreme Court's decision to allow Trump's so-called Muslim ban to continue. And so I'm kind of wondering, yeah, what backlash have you felt from that and what sort of suffering and fear have you seen in your general area?
Well, I mean, we have to dig a little bit deeper into this, you know, this, you know, so-called Muslim ban. I mean, the countries that these people are being banned from are the very countries we're actively destroying, you know, like Syria, like Iran. You know, we have like a covert regime change operation taking place in Iran. It's never ended. It's still ongoing. Countries like Afghanistan and so forth. And so these are countries that we're actively destroying. We're actively arming right-wing rebels. We're, you know, covertly, you know, trying to change the regimes in those countries. And so it's, you know, it's one thing to say that it's a Muslim ban, but I think people need to get really honest and see what this ban is really against. It's against the very refugees who are fleeing our wars. They're fleeing our foreign policy. I think I read this morning that the amount of refugees that have died escaping war just in the last couple of weeks was over 2,000 people. And, you know, I know that, you know, us consumers of news, especially if we're working directly in the news, 2,000 might not seem like that big of a number, but that's like 2,000 human beings, most of which who are children, actually. A lot of these families are escaping with 5 kids at a time and so forth. They're drowning in the seas. And so, you know, we really have to be able to humanize these people that are being banned, you know, from trying to find safety. And so that's, I think, the problem with a lot of this is they're not being humanized. It's just being called a Muslim ban, which it is. You know, for the most part, it is. It's not everybody who's Muslim that's fleeing, but for the most part, it is targeting these Muslims. But where the media has really failed us and where people are kind of getting it wrong is that they're banning people who are the most vulnerable in the world, who have nothing left. And so I think that's where, you know, that connection there with the lack of humanization all goes back to that kind of Islamophobia industry and kind of the backlash that, you know, myself has received and other, you know, Muslim Americans have received. It's like that lack of empathy for the fact that we're all just human beings trying to survive in this world full of war.
Manar, this is Nick Baham. I wanted to ask you sort of on in terms of ideological constructions of what is a good Muslim and what is a bad Muslim and how the Muslim ban sets up these ideological constructions. So how do you see that? You know, what as we're moving forward with this, what is, in your view, a good Muslim and what is a bad Muslim? And I'm speaking specifically in terms of how this travel ban sets up those ideological constructions. Is a good Muslim simply someone who allows a Trump hotel? in their country and a bad Muslim, someone who does not? How do you see this shaping out?
Well, that's a really interesting question because I've heard that argument made. Well, what if the bad guys get through? What do we do about that? And I think that we're asking the wrong question when it comes to, the ban. I think before we even look at banning people and, dehumanizing these victims of wars, we have to look at what brought this situation to the forefront. I mean, we're seeing one of the largest refugee crises since World War II. At the hands and at the cost of, this war and war of aggression and very aggressive and hawkish foreign policy. And so when we think of the bad Muslim, the idea of the bad Muslim, we think of people like ISIS or people like these right-wing rebel groups that are directly a creation of Western imperialism and modern-day colonialism to destabilize these countries, like in Syria, like in Libya, and like Iraq. And so before we even talk about the good and the bad Muslim, we have to really get down to business here and get to the root of the problem. I mean, it's so ironic that Trump is making this argument that, like, well, what if, these bad guys come in, groups like ISIS? And, that's an interesting argument, and it's very possible. I'm not saying that it's not possible that somebody from these terror groups could join in. There's going to be bad guys everywhere, right? We have far-right-wing people here that are extremely violent, that are within our borders, that we should be very afraid of. But at the same time, we need to, instead of attacking the very people, trying to escape war, we need to kind of get to the root of the problem of why are there even these bad guys in the first place? Who's fueling them? Who's arming them? It's extremely ironic for countries, like Great Britain or Germany or whatever countries that are talking, spreading this fear even about these refugees, when they are the ones who are actively arming these right-wing groups that they are supposedly afraid of. And so we have to look at the irony here and call it out for what it is, which is, it's a completely ironic.
Manar, are we also losing any kind of discussion in our news media about secularism? And I'm speaking here to
about
secularism, and not only secularism in quote unquote Islamic states like Oman or Senegal or Iran pre-CIA black ops, but also secularism in the United States. So what I'm speaking to is that there are, as we know, states that are predominantly Islamic or predominantly Christian, and yet there's a high degree of tolerance within those states. People don't wear their fundamentalist beliefs, if they have them, on their sleeves all the time. Are we losing any kind of nuanced discussions about secularism in both Christian and Islamic states?
I think the mainstream media and the corporate media and the establishment are, my family is from the Middle East and they are mostly Muslim, but, the majority of our neighbors were Jewish and they were Christian, they were other Muslims, but nobody pushed their religion on the other person. And that kind of idea of everybody living together is actually a fundamental belief of the Middle East. That's not what the media wants us to know. And they don't want us to believe that. I mean, if you look at the states that are actually being attacked right now by very aggressive foreign policies, those are the states where secularism and, this idea of everybody living together, no matter what your religion is the root of those societies. I mean, if you look at Syria, if you look at Palestine, if you look at Libya, even Iraq, these are historically, these are countries that have had, people from all religious backgrounds, from, atheists to Christians to Muslims to Jews, where people lived together side by side and nobody pushed their religion on the other person. And so if we look at reality, that's how it actually is in the majority of these nations. But what's being pushed on the Middle East and a lot of these African nations, ironically, by the West, is a fundamentalist religious movement of Wahhabism and Salafism that is being funded by the West. And I think that's really where we need to again, get to kind of the root of the problem here is why is there this fundamentalism and why is this idea of unity and secularism where everybody can like live together side by side, why is that being destroyed? It's actually being destroyed by modern day colonialism. And I think that's a really important and interesting topic to bring up. And it's one that's extremely dismissed by the media because they paint the Middle East as like this monolithic, you know, area in the world where everybody is like this fundamentalist, you know, Muslim, Wahhabi, women are oppressed. But in fact, those ideas actually were induced and put onto the Muslim world through British colonialism and, you know, now NATO colonialism.
Manar Mahalish of Mint Press News. Manar, remind our listeners, where can they get their Mint Press News from?
Well, they can get it from our website at mintpressnews.com. We're active on Facebook and on Twitter and on YouTube. So we're pretty active online. They can follow me as well on Twitter and Facebook at Manar Mahalish.
Manar, I could talk to you all day. I really appreciate you coming on the Project Censored show. Thanks a lot.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
All right, we'll be back after this short musical break. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host, Desiree McSwain, Dr. Nicholas Baham III. And we are joined by Amy Casey, who has a few reminders for our listeners.
Thank you, Nolan. Greetings again, listeners. This is Amy Casey with just a few reminders. We do want to hear from you. Please, please, please send us your feedback, any questions, comments, concerns. We want to hear it all. You can send your feedback to projectcensoredradio@gmail.com. Now, in order to keep our show on the air, we need you to show your support and show us some love. For more information, please go to projectcensored.org/radio to learn how you can support the Project Censored show.
Cool. Thank you, Amy. I think we actually have some listener mail to discuss. Nick, you got some mail, didn't you?
Yes, I got a wonderful email from Bill from Redwood City. Bill writes, "Hey, Dr. Baham, I heard you on Project Censored today. I'm a regular Pacifica, Democracy Now, etc. listener. One of the things I've been bugged about lately is the term white nationalist. This is partly because the term is used to describe those hillbillies who didn't get the message about who won the Civil War. They can't possibly be nationalists unless one is speaking of the Confederacy. Then there are the other racist wingnuts that have all sorts of weird ideas about the Constitution and the fringe on the flag and chemtrails. I wouldn't call them nationalists either because they don't seem to care about how their fellow U.S. citizens or the Constitution, especially equal protection, etc. I would urge you, in colloquy with your peers and others, to adopt more appropriate nomenclature. Right-wing militant, violent white racist, neo-Confederate, Christian blasphemer, anti-Christians, Any of these would do, as far as I'm concerned. Even when talking about nationalists in other countries, it's usually a group that wants to justify their hatred and bigotry by wrapping themselves in the flag. This, too, should not be dignified with the term nationalist. Yours truly. And I responded to Bill online and gave Bill's words quite a bit of thought because we are using the term on the broadcast. And I think that Bill does a great job at helping us to think in a more sophisticated way about who is a white nationalist and who is not. I do want, Bill, if you're listening, I do want to give you a little bit of context here. I think we also need to be sophisticated in thinking about how actual white nationalists can manipulate the right-wing militant, the violent white racist, or the neo-Confederate. And I want to draw your attention to an article that I found very compelling that was written July the 6th, in The Atlantic, entitled The Racial and Religious Paranoia of Trump's Warsaw Speech, which happened on July the 5th. This article was written by Peter Beinart. And what he cites is the way that Trump used the term the West 10 times in his speech and our civilization 5 times in his speech. He writes, "The West is a," and this is the Peter Beinart, "the West is a racial and religious term. To be considered Western, a country must be largely Christian, preferably Protestant or Catholic, and largely white. Where there is ambiguity about a country's Westernness, it's because there's ambiguity about or tensions between these two characteristics." And throughout the piece, Beinart talks about Bannon's white nationalist influence on that particular speech. And I do think I want us to remain sophisticated in how we understand this term, but also in how people who may not be properly speaking white nationalists can be manipulated by a white nationalist agenda.
Yeah, I think I read through this email and I thought about the way to use this term, like nationalist, and it brings up some points too. What I've always found kind of odd about the term is that a lot of these people are identified as white nationalists, usually want to tear down many of the foundations of the nation itself. Like, I consider the rise of Trump this anti-Enlightenment period, which the nation's founded on these Enlightenment ideals. Same thing with just like New Deal policies that were a major part of our history. They want to rip those apart too. So it is kind of odd to call them nationalists in that they seem to seek to rip down the very foundations of the nation itself.
Yes, and in that regard, I think Bill really brings up an important point for us to think about on the program.
Mm-hmm. You guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but my kind of understanding or perception of white nationalists, at least in as far as their ideology and what they push it to be, is kind of the idea or the conception of creating a white nation or sustaining a white nation and white-only nation. So in that sense, it makes sense to me to say white nationalist, but then again, you know, it's also easy to kind of lump a lot of groups together. And like you said, a lot of people who may be just influenced by the agenda or by the ideology. So it definitely is good to have some discernment between the groups. But again, if essentially what they're talking about is a white nation that they want to sustain or build, white nationalist is kind of fitting. But correct me if I'm wrong.
I think it's certainly fitting, like when you hear Trump's speech in Poland, talking about Western, talking about Christian, not talking about universal values whatsoever. So, for example, is the right of self-determination a purely Western value? Or do other people have it? And Trump has been setting, through Steve Bannon, has been setting the stage for this Samuel Huntington clash of civilizations, this war between the West and the rest, or the construction of the East. And those are definitively white nationalist expressions. The idea of setting up a Judeo-Christian white majority state. Are they, can they manipulate? The question I think Bill raises here is, can they manipulate just your sort of regular run-of-the-mill? I mean, I don't like the term, but Bill uses it, hillbilly. I think the answer to that is, historically, the answer to that is yes. Those people can be manipulated into that agenda, even if they don't understand that agenda in its complexity.
Yeah, I've recently been reading Hochschild's book, Strangers in Their Own Land. And in the book, she talks about how she interviews white folks in the South, and she talks about how they have seen this, what they see as an attack by liberals, calling them racist and talking about white privilege and these things. And they don't understand where these concepts are coming from, right, even though they're partaking in these behaviors, et cetera. And so they really lean toward like a Trump's America narrative because Trump gives them sort of a safe place, a simple explanation. Well, liberals may have a theoretical point or evidence-based point. It's over the heads because it's not explained to these individuals. And so like you were talking about with white nationalism, Desiree, I was thinking that they take part in many of the same policies that further this white nation, sustaining this white nation, but don't realize they're doing it for that purpose. And so I think by calling them white nationalists, I think that's how you alienate potential allies. And kind of we were talking about the NAR, like how do you tap into that human element to sit down and kind of explain to someone what they're doing rather than label them and make them scared or feel attacked.
Mm-hmm. I have an interesting kind of juxtapose to that, too, because I've been called a black nationalist. And so it's interesting to think about two ideals and I guess what the body or the people kind of believe it to be because they're the driving force. So from a lot of understanding from a lot of past teachers in the African or African-American community like Khalid Muhammad and other people who believe in wanting to create and sustain a black nation anywhere in the world because blacks are so isolated and so impoverished everywhere and lack any infrastructure or superstructure. So the ideal to create that and to be able to sustain that somewhere, even if we can't do it in our own homeland because we're attacked in Africa and all this kind of stuff. So that's kind of one ideal. But again, just hearing it or being labeled black nationalist, it kind of diverts from the real ideal of it. It's not like, you know, you want to kill other races and you want to wipe the world out of anybody but black people. But I can't really necessarily say that that's not what white nationalists believe. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to kind of present this ideal and present like, wow, I think it would be beautiful to see a black community thriving somewhere solely by themselves, for themselves, and being called a black nationalist or being, you know, labeled with that same kind of ideology. But again, that could just be me only going off of what I've heard of white nationalists and what they believe. So,
yeah, Desiree, I think that, you know, certainly the roots of black nationalism and the ideals of people like Edward Blyden and then moving up the line through Marcus Garvey, even Elijah Muhammad, et cetera, are about the right to self-determination. It's a response to white nationalism. And this recognition that if you're going to have any power in the world, you got to have your own land, you got to have access to your resources, you got to be able to build an economy. I could make an argument to you that, which I think you'd probably agree with, because I've also been called a black nationalist quite a bit too, and that just because I teach it as a historical fact, that black success it has to be linked in this country to ownership of land and resources. Mm-hmm. And that's whether we get it here or whether we get it in a wholly segregated community to be able to build up businesses and banks. And if you think about the absence of black banks in this country, or the very few, the dearth of black banks, how do you build a sense of wealth without, you know, credit in lending mm-hmm. in this country? You have to have some capital to be able to do this. And that is central to black nationalism.
Yeah, I think that gets at the heart of the question I was bringing up earlier, though, as well, is taking the time or being able to have the communication with a lot of these white folks who engage in these white nationalist policies but maybe not even know why they do it. Yeah, how would you explain something about like black nationalism and property ownership to say white working class folks who are living in poverty in like Louisiana? You know, how do you, that's like a question. Like, how do you draw that communication?
Yes,
and it seems that the approach that's done by, I would say, the Democratic Party has been this pity party and use these terms over these individuals' heads, which only sort of incites this anger rather than give a logical explanation for our history and why things are the way they are.
Well, the irony is here that the white nationalist who maybe is living in an impoverished community somewhere in southern Indiana, just to pick a place, will not get what they want through white nationalism. They're not going to get a piece of the economy.
That's a really good point.
They're not going to get ownership. So you can buy into the Trump Bannon nationalism. You're not going to get a taste. It's only going to be that top 1%. What you get is racial animus. So that hopefully that keeps you warm at night. Okay, you hate black folk, or you hate Muslims, or you hate women, or you hate gays. Maybe that keeps you warm at night because, you know, Trump has taken away your heating oil assistance for poor people. All right? So you're not even getting that. you're not getting land by removing people from this country through a Muslim ban. What does that mean if you're a white nationalist? Does that mean that you get to move into a property that was previously held by a Syrian refugee somewhere? No, that's not happening. You're getting nothing for it.
That's a good point. So what are we deciding here on the terms? There's so many. I hear hillbilly. I like hillbilly. What else are you thinking here?
Well, I think that what Bill compels us to do is to think through this, as I think we've just done in this discussion, with greater sophistication. And I hear what you're saying, Nolan, about labeling. I think the only way that we're going to be able to effectively communicate through the news to the news media, through the news media, to these types of individuals, which, by the way, has been done. Fred Hampton, a black nationalist, mm-hmm. communicated to so-called white nationalists, right?
I mean, Marcus Garvey sat down with the KKK Grand Wizard, I think
right.
it was. So.
As did Elijah Muhammad.
Right.
So. Invited them to it. That, I think, is the most dangerous moment that can happen in this country, where you get disaffected people of color with disaffected whites. And then we all sit down and we realize, hey, here's the con, right? Mm-hmm. This race thing is the con, okay? Because we're not getting any land or anything from this game. But I think we have agreed to deal, Bill, if you're listening, we have agreed to deal with this with much greater sophistication because of you. So we want to thank you. And we want to thank you for being a dear listener.
Really appreciate it, Bill. And for anybody else out there, please send your listener mail to us at projectcensoredradio@gmail.com. Love to discuss it on the air. We'll be back after this short musical break. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-hosts Desiree McSwain and Nicholas Baham III. And we here at the Media Freedom Foundation produce content that illuminates the work of fact-based journalists around the world and offers alternative narratives to the corporate press. Amy Casey is here to tell us more.
Thank you, Nolan. This is Amy Casey of the Media Freedom Foundation with just some of the stories we are working on. From Diablo Valley College, Project Censored director Mickey Huff and his student Tom Field have nominated a validated independent news story that is a story ignored by the corporate press but covered by the independent press, titled U.S. Government's Little-Known Counter-Propaganda Propaganda Program. The story reports how the U.S. government can, under the Countering Foreign Propaganda and Disinformation Act, simply declare alternative narratives or perspectives that are damaging to U.S. interests as propaganda in an attempt to silence or discredit the source. That can be found at projectcensored.org. In another validated independent news story, this time from Citrus College, Project Censored Associate Director Andy Lee Roth and his student Johnny Zambrano have published Facebook Buys Sensitive Data About Its Users to Offer Marketers Increasingly Specific Targeted Advertising. This article looks at Facebook's history since 2012 of purchasing sensitive data about users' offline lives from data brokers in order to use that information or sell it to advertisers. That can be found at projectcensored.org. At the Global Critical Media Literacies webpage, gcml.org, Dr. Nolan Higdon and his student Eduardo Gonzalez from California State University East Bay have released Youth's Dreams Dying in the Golden State. The article observes that the American dream is unavailable to most millennials as Bay Area rent prices continue to increase, but creative options can still be found with an open mind and a little compromise. Also at gcml.org, Bay Area residents are moving to the Pacific Northwest in droves. From California State University East Bay, Dr. Nolan Higdon and his student, Justin Much, describe the exodus from the San Francisco Bay Area to Portland and Seattle in response to increased cost of living and traffic, as well as the seemingly endless housing crisis. Also from California State University East Bay, Dr. Nolan Higdon and his student, Maximino Cisneros, have published, "Was the Warriors Championship Parade Really What Oakland Needed?" The story examines the cost of celebration and postulates who should foot the bill for a city juggling many economic issues such as hiring freezes and budget cuts for the school district. The story can be found at gcml.org. At this time, I would like to remind our listeners to go to projectcensored.org/show. There, you can access free content and show your support for Project Censored. I am Amy Casey, and that is the news that did not make the news.
Thanks a lot, Amy. As you can tell, I've been busy. A lot of students producing a lot of work. A lot of great work, though, so it keeps me going. You've been listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Nolan Higdon with Desiree McSwain and Nicholas Bayham III. Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips are executive producers and hosts. Our intern and special announcer is Amy Casey. Mitch Scorza is our producer. Melissa Marinsello is our engineer. The Project Censored Show airs on nearly 40 stations around the U.S. Please follow us and like us on Facebook. Send us an email at projectcensoredradio@gmail.com and visit our website online at projectcensored.org, where you can find the archives of all our radio shows for the past 6 years, as well as 40 years of news that didn't make the news. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time. Up next, Terra Verde.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Naomi Klein, No is Not Enough. Resisting Trump's Shock Politics and Winning the World We Need. Naomi Klein says that a corporate political takeover got Donald Trump elected, and now an unprecedented number of people are becoming engaged in movements and politics. She writes that the current rise in activism can resist his policies. However, saying no is not enough. In this talk, she explains that we have the opportunity to build a different economy and a different relationship between humans and the natural world and between each other in community. Naomi Klein wants us to move forward to what she defines as the most pressing question: how do we win deep political transformation so that the kind of living models that communities are already forging can spread at the velocity that is required to keep us all safe? Naomi Klein is internationally famous for having written several major books, among them This Changes Everything: Capitalism versus the Climate in 2014, The Shock Doctrine in 2007, and No Logo in 2000. Her most recent book, No Is Not Enough, is coming out in June 2017. The award-winning journalist, syndicated columnist, filmmaker, and author was the keynote speaker at the Living Future Conference in Seattle, Washington, on March 19, 2017. Living Future is a forum for the green building movement. The ideals that they hold dear are how to build communities that are socially just, culturally rich, and ecologically restorative. Here is Naomi Klein.
It's really nice, actually, to be speaking to you near the end, after you have already heard from so many exciting speakers who have done so much to name the challenges ahead. And I'm able also to take it as a given that you understand the urgency of the need to build a very, very different kind of economy. If you didn't understand that, you wouldn't be engaged in the work that you're doing to try to forge a different relationship between humans and the natural world and between each other in community relationships of reciprocity, regeneration, and renewal. You wouldn't be trying to restore the natural world to health or to build regenerative communities. And you're doing all that already, and I thank you for that. And it means that I can also skip the usual apocalyptic portion of my presentations where I, you know, prove that climate change is happening, that it is very, very scary and dangerous, and we're basically out of time. We will just move forward to the most pressing question, which is, how do we win deep political transformation so that the kinds of living models that you are all forging in your work, in your communities, can spread at the velocity that is required to keep us all safe? You know, I don't like this phrase we sometimes hear, you know, how do we take it to scale? Because I don't think it necessarily has to be big. But I do think we have to do a lot of small and medium size very, very quickly, right? And we don't do that without policy, without real political change. And so when I look at the equation on the podium in front of me, the genius is there, it's in this room, right? So the challenge has, for a very long time, has not been about whether or not it is possible technically to do this. It's often presented as that kind of challenge, right? Well, the technology isn't there, and so on, right? Well, it is there, right? And we know this. We know from fantastic researchers like Mark Jacobson at Stanford University that with existing technology, we can get to 100% renewables for the entire economy well before mid-century, which is what we need to do if we're going to keep temperatures below 1.5 to 2 degrees, which is what we said we were going to do in Paris, right? So the problem is not lack of genius. I don't think it is lack of courage, although there are issues around courage, but I agree that it is more about unleashing the latent courage, creating opportunities to express that. But I think there is another piece of this equation, which is about power, which is about how do we build political power? Because we are up against forces that are actively trying to stop us, right? And often when we talk about sustainability and regenerative economies, we forget about the power equation. How do we build movements that can win? Okay? So I want to focus on that a little bit. And I was thinking about it recently because I was in Santa Barbara at a conference that was celebrating women in the environment, and it was celebrating the particular role that Santa Barbara played in launching the modern environmental movement. So they were talking about how the very first Earth Day was ground zero of Santa Barbara in 1970, and that Earth Day, which, you know, you all know this history, you know, millions of people participated in these teach-ins and demonstrations across the country. It was this awakening, and that led to a series of breakthroughs in legislation that really formed the backbone for environmental law in this country, right? The meaningful strengthening of the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, and it happened very, 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 very quickly in rapid staccato succession in the early 1970s, which is an important reminder, I think, sometimes when we feel overwhelmed by how much change needs to happen and how quickly, is that when it does start happening, it often happens in this way, like a dam breaking, and then suddenly things start changing all at once, right? You know, it reminds me of the Nelson Mandela quote, you know, it's it always seems impossible until it's done, right? And so I was thinking about that, and you know, and frankly, I think the idea that Santa Barbara launched the environmental movement is slightly problematic, and I told them so. You know, I think we should probably backdate it to the earliest indigenous resistance to colonial land grabbing. But just, you know, for the sake of argument, let's say Santa Barbara did it, or did something very important along the way. And if we look at the ingredients for what produced that moment, right? It wasn't they had a big protest and won a bunch of laws, right? There was something else that happened a little bit earlier, and that has to do with the role of crisis and the role of shock, right? Because 1 year before Earth Day was the 1969 Santa Barbara oil spill, right? For the younger people in this audience who don't know this history, this was an incredibly shocking event, right? Oil drilling off the coast of California was already controversial, and then there was what at the time was the largest oil spill in American history. Thousands of birds were killed. There were these harrowing images of seals and sea lions and otters absolutely coated in oil, these beautiful beaches covered in oil, cliffs covered in oil. And the record for the world's largest oil spill has since been surpassed, first by the Exxon Valdez, then by the Deepwater Horizon. But it was intensely shocking, and there was this response, right? Earth Day the next year, this staccato legislation. And that's the way the story is often told, right? Crisis, reaction, legislation, right? The sort of frog in boiling water theory, right? We were shocked, we jumped, right? But that leaves out what I think is a very important ingredient in what actually produces deep political change in a culture. And that was what was happening before the shock, right? So think about the timing of this. It's 1969. It is the end of this decade of revolutionary thought on so many different fronts, right? Whether it's the counterculture, whether it's the civil rights movements, whether around the world it is the rise of anti-colonial movements, rising up, overthrowing colonial powers, overthrowing dictatorship. Revolution is in the air. Everything is on the table. People are dreaming in public. Most notably, Martin Luther King, about a vision of radical equality and inclusion. But also the counterculture is putting everything on the table, questioning everything about industrial society, from the nuclear family to the suburbs to the equation of happiness with consumer bubbles, right? And this eventually led to the limits of growth and questioning the role of growth at the center of a capitalist economy. And within the environmental context, earlier in the decade, 1962, you had the publication of Silent Spring, which was a deep challenge to a previous era of environmental writing and thinking, because Rachel Carson was not talking about the need to sort of save particular green museums, green spaces in which to recreate, but really she was challenging this fundamental relationship of humans as conquerors of nature. Right, as dominators of nature. The whole idea, she called them the control men, who imagined, in her mind, with such profound ignorance, that they could control the natural world with the use of these military tools that had been honed in the Second World War, right, and apply them to the natural world to try to get rid of insects and not realizing the rebound effects that would unleash. So it was really about a paradigm shift, right? Really about challenging what is the role of humans in the natural world. And you know, you could see it as a demotion, you could see it as a promotion, right? That we have to understand that we live in community with one another and with all living beings and in relationships of reciprocity with the systems upon all life depends. So all of this is happening in the 60s. And then the spill pierces it, right? And the spill is held up as the ultimate evidence, as Exhibit A, of the madness of this system that would sacrifice all of this life, all of this beauty, just for short-term profits, right? So that is why the shock was able to be metabolized in this way. You know, and I remember when I was covering the Deepwater Horizon disaster, talking to oceanographers who were so frustrated that that spill wasn't producing anything. They were saying, you know, the Santa Barbara oil spill got us the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and the Endangered Species Act. What is this going to get us? You know, better, you know, a little bit of better technology on oil rigs. That seems to be the only legacy. So why is that? And I think a big part of it was that in the 60s, there was this presence of dreaming in public, of really pushing the envelope. And it is worth remembering that the president who passed so many of these laws, or under whom so many of these laws were passed, was not that good a guy. It was Richard Nixon, a name that's been in the news lately as our pundits search for any kind of precedent for what we're seeing in the White House. And the truth is that Nixon, though he shared a fair bit in common with Trump, his duplicity, paranoia, obstruction, the truth is he passed more and better environmental legislation than Obama. And that is not because he was a better guy. I think it confirms what the great late people's historian Howard Zinn once wrote, that it is less about who is sitting in the White House than who is sitting in the streets, in the cafeterias, in the halls of government, in the factories, who is protesting, who is occupying offices and demonstrating. Those are the things that determine what happens, as Howard wrote. So the political mood in the 60s and early 70s was so radical, in fact, so transformational. Revolution was in the air, that these laws that Richard Nixon passed were seen as a compromise, because the demand for challenging the fundamentals of the economic system, those were on the table, right? So this seemed, these were moderate reforms in that context, because the center had been moved. So let's review these ingredients that produced such interesting change. You had a period of upheaval, unapologetic utopian thought. It's punctuated, pierced by a painful shock, which is held up as Exhibit A. And you had the existence of a movement before the shock comes that was already questioning everything. And in this volatile, indeed revolutionary context, meaningful reforms are offered as a compromise. So I offer this as a kind of a formula that we can think about as we try to hold on to some hope that it might not be too late, okay? But it shows how heavy a lift it is, but it also shows that it's possible. And I think if we look at American history, we see that in those moments of staccato change, the staccato progressive transformation, these factors have been there. Most notably, in the aftermath of the great market crash of 1929, right, where so much of the progressive infrastructure of this country, public housing, Social Security, unemployment insurance, electrification, the legacy of the New Deal, regulation of the banks, so much was won in the aftermath of the greatest crisis that capitalism has ever experienced, the crash of 1929. But what was the context for that? Well, it was a context in which revolution once again was in the air. You had a working class that was talking about socialism, that was reading Marx, that was familiar with the vision of W.E.B. Du Bois and of a united interracial working class movement, that was questioning the role of work in our lives. I mean, this is what I find most interesting looking back at the labor movement of the 1920s and 30s. You know, today the labor movement is all about asking for jobs, right? But in this era, much of the labor movement was about asking for leisure, asking for less work, right? The right to a good life, a good quality of life. And it was really about that essential question of what is a good life? What is happiness? What does every human being have a right to? So that was the context in which the crash came, is held up as evidence of the barbarism of the system, right? That we could gamble all of our futures on this casino that could crash so spectacularly that you would have stockbrokers jumping out of windows and millions of people losing their homes and their farms and tent cities and Central Park and so on. There was then a wave of revolutionary and disruptive organizing in the 1930s, a general strike in Minneapolis, an 83-day shutdown of the West Coast by longshore workers, the Flint sit-down strikes, radical demands. The muckraking journalist Upton Sinclair ran for governor of California in this period, and you know, he was kind of the Bernie Sanders of his day, this unlikely populist candidate. And the centerpiece of his campaign was the New Deal isn't going far enough. We should give workers the means of production so that they can turn their factories into workers' cooperatives. And he got almost a million votes in California. He was moving the center. And it was this context that allowed FDR to sell the New Deal as a compromise, because the alternative looked that scary to the elites, right? So I think we have to understand these dynamics, or what really produces political change. Because I think for so long, the environmental movement has been under this very misguided illusion that if we just scare people, educate people, create an understanding of the depth of this crisis, they will wake up and be like that frog in boiling water and jump, right? And that's an incredibly ahistorical version of how change happens, right? And I often get pushback by my friends in the environmental movement when I write books with capitalism in the title, right? They're like, well, you're making it harder. Why are you making this about capitalism? It's just about carbon. And first of all, you know, I don't think we can separate carbon from capitalism. This is I don't think it's a coincidence that the commercial steam engine and the Wealth of Nations came out in the same year, not to mention the founding of this country. It was a very action-packed year. This history is entirely intertwined. But more to the point, I don't think I'm making it harder by talking about radical ideas, by putting radical ideas on the table. I think I'm making it easier, because I think this is how change happens, when radical ideas are in the air. The other thing that I think is useful about, you know, in terms of particularly the 1930s as a model, is though the kinds of change that were introduced in that era are not the kinds of change that you guys are working towards. I mean, these were big centralized state solutions for the most part, right? And you know, a lot of it was fossil fuel based in terms of the electrification and damming of rivers and so on. The velocity of it is of the order that we need right now, right? And the only other analogy that we can reach towards that proves that it is possible for humans to act as quickly as we need to act in the face of this crisis is the way this economy was transformed during the Second World War. Also not the kinds of changes that we want. We don't want our factories to stop making cars and start making fighter jets. We want them to maybe stop making cars and start making public transit, start making wind turbines. But it is possible for this kind of change to happen if we understand the dynamics. So shocks no longer have this kind of wake-up call function, right? And this is what I documented in the shock doctrine, is that it's actually the opposite. And what I found when I was researching the shock doctrine, and you know, for those of you who aren't familiar with that work, what the shock doctrine is a phrase that I came up with to describe this strategy that was developed by the right in the 1970s to use periods of crisis and the disorientation that follows a large-scale shock in a society to push through very unpopular so-called reforms. Okay, I quote Milton Friedman saying, only a crisis, real or perceived, produces real change. Our job is to keep the ideas ready until the politically impossible becomes politically inevitable. And this is, in the examples that I use, is incredibly anti-democratic. So, for instance, New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina should have been a wake-up call for our side, right? It should have been a wake-up call, because here you have this crisis born of a collision between heavy weather of the kind we're going to see more and more of because of climate change. When you warm oceans, you have more ferocious storms. turned into a catastrophe because the storm slams into weak and neglected public infrastructure. The levees should have held. They did not hold because there had been warning after warning and the Army Corps had not repaired the levees, right? FEMA couldn't find New Orleans for 5 days. You had complete dysfunction. This is the legacy of neoliberalism, right? You neglect the public sphere for 4 decades. You cut it back, and lo and behold, it cannot deal with a crisis of this magnitude. And layered on top of all of that is systemic racism. And so the people who are abandoned on their rooftops in the Superdome are then animalized and vilified on television for going and getting the food and water that they need, right? And vigilantes come into the city. And I was in New Orleans in this period, and black people were being hunted and being shot by police, by vigilantes, who were afraid that they were going to somehow escape the city and go to the suburbs. And it was just like so sci-fi. It was the vision of the future we've imagined so many times in every sci-fi film, that, you know, I often say that our greatest challenge is not to reimagine that future of a little bubbles of fortress winners surrounded by hordes of locked out losers, which is essentially the plot of every sci-fi movie you're ever going to see, but imagine a different kind of future where we come together across divides in periods of crisis and believe that we can do that in our bones. So that, I think, is our task, is to tell a different kind of story. And I think the reason, you know, we've had these moments where, which should have been wake-up calls, Katrina, the 2008 financial crisis, right, which was so clearly the result of, you know, getting rid of the laws that were passed in the aftermath of the great crash of 1929, like Glass-Steagall's, deregulating the financial markets, just letting these bubbles inflate, and allowing these outrageous profits to be made, and then the bill for it gets passed on to regular people who were the most victimized by the crisis, who were losing their homes. They get victimized through more cutbacks to pay for the trillions of dollars in bailouts. So this should have been a wake-up call, and indeed it was a kind of a wake-up call. Around the world, you had a wave of organizing, protesting, occupations. In this country, it was called Occupy Wall Street. In Southern Europe, they called it the movement of the squares because central squares in Greece and Spain and Portugal were being occupied for months on end. It was the increase in food prices that set off the Arab Spring in the same period. So all around the world, people were saying, no, we do not want this. And there was a slogan, we will not pay for your crisis, that ricocheted around the world. But somehow it wasn't enough. And the reason it wasn't enough, and the reason I called my new book No Is Not Enough, is because what is clear from this is that just saying no, that is a bad idea, while it may slow down or hold back the worst of the attacks, it is not going to get us where we need to go. We need a convincing, inspiring yes that is a vision of the future that will keep us safe. You know, and the reason we haven't had that is not because, you know, we're bad people. It is because I would argue that we are products of our time and that we need to understand the flip side of the neoliberal project that began in this country under Reagan and in the UK under Thatcher and then was globalized around the world as not just a project that was advancing a set of economic policies, market fundamentalism, privatization, deregulation, low taxes offset with cuts to government spending. Flip side of that in this country was mass criminalization of communities of color and mass incarceration. It's not just that. It is also a war on the imagination. That was always central to the neoliberal project, was saying there is no alternative, as Margaret Thatcher said, that there is nothing but this. Any idea you could possibly have about another way that we could live is inherently wrong and suspect, right? So we now have generations that have grown up without the muscle of imagining other possible futures and without those examples. And this is why the work that you're doing It's so important in terms of dispelling the idea that there is only one way to live, only one way to build, only one way to interact with each other. And there are many examples of this, growing examples of this, of proving to people through action, because you're not going to prove it to them just by saying it. You're going to prove it by feeling it, by living it, by seeing it, by touching it. So the good news is that we're starting to see a revival of the utopian imagination.
That was part one of a one-hour talk, No is Not Enough, Resisting Trump's Shock Politics and Winning the World We Need by Naomi Klein.
Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Approximately 20% of the people who are motionless and locked into a deep coma, wholly unable to move or respond, have a conscious awareness. This conscious awareness may be determined with the use of functional magnetic resonance imaging, commonly called fMRI. This imaging reveals the increased blood flow to specific areas of the brain when a person focuses on a certain idea or image. In this program, we visit with Adrian Owen, PhD, author of Into the Gray Zone, a neuroscientist explores the border between life and death. Dr. Owen, who thoroughly enjoys neurobiology and his rock and roll band, began to develop imaging techniques allowing a conscious person locked in a coma to respond yes or no to a given question. Owen is currently the Canada Excellence Research Chair in Cognitive Neuroscience and Imaging at the Brain and Mind Institute of Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. As part of our continuing series on dementia, we visited with Dr. Owen from his office in London, Ontario, Canada, on June 28, 2017. We began when I asked him to explain the difference between magnetic resonance imaging and functional magnetic resonance imaging.
They're both actually very similar. An MRI scanner, the MRI has been around for about 40 years or so now. And in the early years, it was principally just used as a way of taking photographs of the brain. In that way, it's very similar to a CAT scan or a CT scan that people will be familiar with. So what you get is a sort of a photograph, a static image of the brain. And in the early 1990s, the technique was developed so that it could perform so-called functional MRI. And what this is, it's like a movie. It's the activity of the brain. You can see the brain doing its thing over time. So it typically a scan will last anything from a few minutes to sometimes a few hours, and we scan the brain, and what we're measuring are changes in the flow of blood around the brain, because that corresponds to where all the action is happening. If you're thinking a particular type of thought and it's activating a particular area of your brain, then we can detect that in the fMRI scanner.
So what you distinguish when you ask people to think of two particular categories, one playing tennis and the other walking through their home, initiates thinking in separate parts of the brain. Can you explain the separateness of those two forms of thinking?
I can, yeah. I mean, I wish I could tell you that, you know, fMRI or, you know, this, the technology behind it was at the stage where I could just put you in the, into the scanner and work out what you were thinking. But we're not quite there yet. I can't even put you in the scanner and work out whether you're thinking a yes and a no. I mean, that's a very, you know, sophisticated question. It's one that we haven't cracked yet. But there are some things that you could do in the scanner, or some things that you could imagine that I can detect. So, for example, if I ask you to imagine moving your arms around as if, say, you were playing a game of tennis, it will produce activity in a particular area at the top and towards the front of the brain, known as the premotor cortex. And this happens every time. Every time I say to you, imagine playing tennis, this area of the brain will light up. And if I say, now stop, the activity will disappear. And it's to do with, it's an area that's involved in producing those sorts of movements. Now, what I can then do is use that as a sort of a proxy for a word like no or yes. I could say to you, I'm going to ask you a question. And if the answer is yes, imagine playing tennis now. If that area of the brain lights up, then we know the person is saying yes. Now, another scenario we use a lot is to ask people to imagine that they're walking around their houses. So we have, you know, we have a very sophisticated system in our brains for us to know where we are. Imagine, you know, you walk through your front door. Imagine you're trying to go to the bedroom. You don't sort of just wander around the house until you get there. You go exactly there because you have a very sophisticated spatial map of your house that's developed over time, and all that information is stored in your brain. And you can imagine that information as well. You don't just need to actually activate it when you're in your house. You can imagine being in your house. And when people do that, we see an entirely different network of areas light up. And what we can do is we can get people to do that to convey a no. So typically with the patients, once we've established that there's some awareness there, we'll say, well, imagine playing tennis for a yes. Imagine walking around your house for a no. Now, here's a question. We ask them the question. As long as it's got a yes or no answer, typically they can convey that answer very effectively.
What would be a typical question?
Well, in the early days, so this is now, we've been doing this for 7 years, but early on, we were as surprised as anybody else that this actually worked. But B, we really needed to make sure that it was reliable and robust and replicable. You know, these are high stakes situations. We're dealing with patients for whom decisions are being made about life and death. So early on, we asked questions that we could go and verify later. So there would be things like, do you have any brothers or sisters? And we'd take down the answer, yes or no, and then we'd go to the family and we'd say, okay, he says yes, he has brothers, or no, he has sisters. Is your mother still alive? These are sort of concrete questions in the outside world that we can go and verify that this person is truly in there communicating with us. But they're not questions that we, you know, as carers and investigators typically know the answers to. If a patient comes to me, I don't typically know whether their mother is still alive or not. So, you know, that made it completely unbiased, and that's how we verified the science to make it absolutely clear to everybody that this is a real thing and we really were communicating. But then, of course, you can move on to ask questions that you don't know the answers to. Things like, are you in pain? There's no such thing as a pain meter. I can't put something on you right now and tell you how much pain you're in. The only way I know whether you are in any pain is if you tell me and if you estimate the amount of pain that you're in. And it's the same for these patients. So it's something that we ask many, many people now. Are you in pain?
And can you ask them a leading question? Is your pain on a scale of 1 to 10 above 5?
Yes, that's exactly what we've done, and that's what we've written about recently. Because obviously, people listening to this are probably thinking, "Well, how far can you get just answering yes and no questions?" And the answer is, you really have to do it like that old party game, 20 questions we would call it in the UK, where you have to ask a rather broad question, like, "Are you in pain?" If the person were to say yes, then you would say, "Well, you know, is it physical pain?" And they might say yes. It's okay. Is it in the top half of your body? And they might say yes. And you gradually have to, the only way that you can do this is to gradually drill down through the questions until you find out what you really want to know, that this person has immense pain in their right foot, for example. So the other important area, I think, is trying to improve patients' quality of lives with respect to the experiences they have or what they get exposed to. And it's a fact that if you are unfortunate enough to get yourself into one of these rather serious gray zone situations, then you're going to get to experience an awful lot of what you used to enjoy. If you used to watch a lot of basketball, then you're going to get sat up in front of an awful lot of basketball games when you know there's nothing else for you to do. If you used to like listening to heavy metal music, you're going to get to listen to a lot of heavy metal music. The problem is, you know, sometimes these patients stay in this situation for many, many years, for decades even. And, you know, maybe 2 decades later, you're not still into heavy metal music, but it's almost as though time ceases to change. Time stands still, you know, for these patients. So the other area that we're working in a lot now is to ask questions about what patients would like to happen to them, what they would like to, how they would like to spend their days, what time they would like to go to bed, these sorts of things. Because of the patients who have recovered, and there are a few examples of this in the book, of patients who've come back from the gray zone and live to tell their tale, and many of those patients report immense frustration with having no control over their lives. Every single decision was made for them, and being able to return some of that decision making about even simple things like, you know, what music am I going to listen to today, I think could seriously improve somebody's quality of life.
Have you yet been able to develop a situation where someone can express an idea to you or the other scientists with whom you work other than in a yes or a no answer?
That's a really great question, and it's one that we're working really hard on. I'm sad to say the answer is no. At the moment, we're stuck with yes and no questions. But we have some techniques that work in healthy participants. Obviously, we rely a lot on volunteers, students, and people from the community that come in and help us with our research. And we do have techniques that allow people to spell, for example. And this will be a huge step forward. If somebody could spell out a word or a sentence with their brain, I think that would make a huge difference. And that is possible in the healthy brain. It's something that we, and I don't believe anybody else, has managed to pull off with one of these patients in the gray zone state yet, but I certainly believe it's going to happen in the near future.
Well, doing that, you would rely on the knowledge that the person has gained or laid down in their mind after the incident that otherwise causes them to be in a vegetative state. So can you tell us the circumstances, if possible, about how people are able to lay down knowledge after the fact of the incident?
Let me give you another example of a patient I described in some detail in the book. This was a young man from here in Canada who came to us after a so-called anoxic brain injury, and that is that he'd suffered prolonged loss of oxygen to his brain. He seemed to be in a complete vegetative state. He was entirely non-responsive and had been that way for many months. And we put him into the scanner and we saw nothing going on in his brain. We tried a bunch of new techniques that we'd been developing. And again, we saw absolutely nothing. And I sent him home with his parents and I said, you know, I'm really sorry. I can't find any evidence that your son has any awareness of the outside world. 9 months later, he walked back into my lab. He had recovered. He walked through the door. He could talk. He was going back to college. That was remarkable in itself. We don't see that very often. What was even more remarkable, in fact, what stunned me, is that he could remember everything about being scanned 9 months earlier. He could report every last detail of going into the scanner, the name of the person who had scanned him, who it was who scanned him, where it was, every last detail of what had happened to him during those 4 days here in my lab, he was able to report. So clearly, he'd been laying down memories. He'd been laying down extremely effective memories of what was going on around him, who was around him, what they were saying. Now, how this happened, we don't know. How he was able to do this, it still amazes me. It's still extraordinary, but he was. And I think only by exploring these gray zone states with the sorts of technology that we have available to us will we ever be able to, you know, understand how these things can actually occur.
In your experience of the 20% of the people who are in a vegetative state are able to communicate using the yes or no responses that you have mentioned, how many of those do you find are able to lay down post-incident memories?
Actually, almost all of them. I would say that typically, at least here, these patients either can't do anything or they can do almost everything. So most of the patients that I describe in the book are really sort of locked inside themselves. They appear to be entirely non-responsive and entirely unable to produce any responses. They appear to be unaware. But in fact, once we get them into the scanner, once we start asking them questions, it becomes apparent not only that they are aware, they know who they are and where they are, but also, to address your question more directly, they're laying down memories and they've experienced the last year, 10 years, 20 years of their lives, much the same way that you and I would experience our lives, except, of course, they weren't able to move around and interact with their environment. So most of those patients are certainly still laying down memories. However, there's another class of very similar patients who we refer to as being in the minimally conscious state. And this is a condition that's very much like the vegetative state. But patients are typically able to give some indication that they have some level of awareness. And I think for them, the situation is much more difficult. I think it's much less clear that those patients are actually laying down new memories. It's not clear that they're completely aware of where they are and who they are and the condition they're in. And that's an enormous population that we're talking about.
Let's talk about another and separate area, and that's ethics. In my other profession as an attorney here in California, doing a lot of estate planning, I ask people to fill out a healthcare directive. One of the questions is, if you are in a vegetative state, how long would you like to be kept alive? With what you have been able to discover, you are in a position to ask people, do you want to die or would you like to be kept alive? How do you deal with the ethics involved?
I think that's an enormously difficult question. I'm very glad that you asked it. Now, we clearly are moving into a situation where some of these techniques can be used to ask patients what they would like to happen to them. And I think this is an enormously important area. One of the things that really drives this research is trying to return some of the decision-making to the patient themselves. I've seen many, many examples where families are making decisions on behalf of the patient. And they could be relatively straightforward decisions like, do we want to enter our loved one into this particular new drug trial? Or they could be really difficult decisions like, do we really want this person to carry on in the situation that they're in? And it is a nightmare scenario. Nobody wants to have to make those sorts of decisions on behalf of somebody else. And one of the things behind this research is can we return some of that decision-making capacity or ability to the patient themselves? I can tell you that in some cases, yes, we can, and yes, we will be able to. It's a minority of cases, but it's certainly plausible.
Our guest is Dr. Adrian Owen, author of Into the Gray Zone, A Neuroscientist Explores the Border Between Life and Death. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Adrian, let's discuss the ethics of asking a person in the condition which you have described, would you like to die?
This is exactly one of the issues that I talk about in the book, because it's extremely important. If somebody were to just walk into a doctor's surgery and say, I want to die today, we typically don't just say, fine, here you go, take this pill and you can die if it's an otherwise healthy person. And there are good reasons for that. The person this may be a transient phase they're going through. They may have just had a piece of really bad news that they'll get over in a few days. And we have a process in place and a very good sort of ethical framework for how we deal with those sorts of situations. And I don't think the situation is any different for a patient who is in one of these gray zone states where they appear to be unaware, but actually it turns out that they aren't. And by that I mean, if one of these patients says, I want to die, please turn me off, we're not going to be able to just act on that without really thinking through the repercussions. Is this a transient phase? Is this person perhaps depressed? I mean, they might have very good reasons to be depressed. Do they have what we often refer to as mental capacity? Are they able to understand the implications of the decisions that they're making and the answer to the questions that they're giving? And you would, if you were ever going to act on that sort of information, you'd have to work through all of those questions in exactly the same way that you would with the example I've just used of the person who walks into the doctor's surgery and says, "I want to die." It's the same situation. You'd have to establish it. And you know, it's questionable how you would go about doing that in a patient who can only ask yes or no questions. But I actually think it's doable. It would be extremely labor-intensive, but I think it's something that could be done.
By labor-intensive, you mean in posing the questions and submitting them or asking them to the patient, who then answers with the yes or no imagery that you have discussed earlier today.
Exactly. So at the moment, each of those questions takes about 5 minutes for us to be absolutely confident that we've got the right answer. You know, we can go faster sometimes, but most of the time, you know, I like to leave it 5 minutes of scanning. So every yes and no question takes 5 minutes. They've got to go into the scanner itself. This is expensive and non-portable technology. The person is lying. They typically can't stay there for many hours. We can only keep people comfortable for maybe an hour and a half. So the number of questions that you can ask in any session is limited both by the time it takes and the comfort of the patient.
It truly begs the question of who is in charge, the patient, the medical staff who act as the questioners, or the surrogates, the family, who would decide for a person who has no ability to move or respond but is clear in their cognitive abilities.
For me, the duty we have, and now that we know that these people exist, the duty that we have is to give them as much freedom as we can. I mean, we're not in a position where we can offer them a cure. We're not in a position where we can pull them out of this situation, but we should allow them wherever possible to be able to exert some autonomy, as we call it, some control over their lives. Because as I said previously, at the moment, almost every decision is made for them.
So let's move then to Alzheimer's disease, the cognitive debilitating neurodegenerative condition that some people have. They're otherwise physically healthy, but their mind is beginning to decay.
Well, yeah, this is another condition that I talk about in my book Into the Gray Zone, because I think it is a gray zone state. When somebody starts to degenerate with Alzheimer's disease, and I'm guessing that almost everybody listening to this will now know somebody or know of somebody who has this degenerative disease. These patients change fundamentally. Their personalities change, their memories change, the whole way in which they interact with the outside world changes. And what becomes apparent is, particularly at the later stages of the disease, is it's no longer clear whether they're here or not. And if they're here, what do we mean by that? What do we mean by they're here? And if they're not here, what do we mean by that? And in that sense, it's a truly gray zone state, that we judge the patients based on their behavior. What can they remember? What can they still do? Can they still dress themselves, wash themselves, so on and so forth? But what we've learned from these other gray zone states that we've been studying is that you can't judge a book by its cover. A person may have much more going on than is apparent from simply examining them clinically or looking at what behaviors they're still capable of doing. And I think this is an extremely interesting and important area, that as we develop these techniques to become relevant to some of these other conditions that typically occur later in life, I think we may well find that some patients have capacities that we didn't previously imagine possible. And they may be, so I'm not saying that these patients are going to end up being able to do complex math and really drive a car or design a bridge, but can they still experience enjoyment? Can they still derive pleasure from some of the things like listening to music, looking at art, watching movies? Can we get inside the heads of people in these situations and answer the big question: what is it like to be that? What is it like to have Alzheimer's disease?
Well, Adrian Owen, author of Into the Gray Zone, a neuroscientist explores the border between life and death. I want to thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask some questions about you. And the first one is, can you tell us about a eureka or an aha moment that changed your life or gave you a new perspective into your world?
I certainly can. 2006, we were scanning a patient who had been involved in a road traffic accident. She had apparently been in a vegetative state for 5 months, and she hadn't responded in any way to any form of external stimulation. As far as we were concerned, she was completely disconnected from the world. Now, that was the first time we ever put a patient into a scanner and asked them to activate their brain when we said do so. We said to her, imagine playing tennis. And the moment that we looked at her brain and it lit up just when we said imagine playing tennis was really my eureka moment, because this person went from being a body, a vegetative state patient in the scanner, to being a real person again. At that moment, I realized that this person was in there. They had a life. They were aware that they were in a scanner. They were aware of the situation that they were in. And that was there isn't another moment in my scientific career that can compete with that.
Was that question, imagine playing tennis, an intentional question?
It was. We'd spent many months developing that technique up until that point in healthy volunteers that had come into our scanner, and we tried many different questions to find the one that was most reliable. And it turns out that imagining playing tennis is a really great way of activating one particular area of the brain. So we knew what we wanted to do. But what was remarkable is this was the first time we'd ever tried it in a vegetative state patient.
And my next question, Adrian Owen, what would you like to do with the remainder of your one precious life?
I'd like to continue in this area. I enjoy what I do very much. I really enjoyed writing the book. This is the first time that I've written a story for a lay audience rather than a scientific audience. I've spent many, many years writing scientific papers about the science that we do. And looking back over 20 years, I realize there's a really interesting story here that I think many people will enjoy reading, will get something from. So writing science for the general public is something that I'd like to do again and do more of, but also to continue alongside that by developing these techniques. Because even though it sounds as though I do this for the patients and for the families and so on and so forth, it's also a scientific adventure. It's exciting and interesting to be able to ask these really big scientific questions like, why are we here? What does it mean to be human? What is consciousness? And I get to do all that stuff, and that's tremendously exciting, and that's something that I'd certainly like to continue doing for the rest of my life.
Along with playing in your rock and roll band.
Yes, well, that is something that I'd rather that career also took off. That would also be a bonus. If my music career were to take off and I could tour the world as a rock and roll star, I would truly die a happy man.
And finally, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
I'm going to recommend a book that's actually rather old now, but it's the book that got me into science. It's by Richard Dawkins, the British scientist, and it's a book called The Selfish Gene. And it's not necessarily because of the content of the book. It's because of the enthusiasm of the writing about the life of a scientist and about the pursuit of interesting scientific questions. I love the book. I've read it many times since. And it's far superior to any of his later work and on a completely different subject. But it's a really great sort of introduction to why science is so exciting.
Adrian Owen, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you for having me. I've enjoyed it very much.
Dr. Adrian Owen is the author of Into the Gray Zone, a neuroscientist explores the border between life and death. He's currently the Canada Excellence Research Chair in Cognitive Neuroscience and Imaging at the Brain and Mind Institute of Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. The book Adrian Owen recommends is The Selfish Gene by Richard Dawkins. This program was recorded on June 28th, 2017. There are over 630 archive editions of Radio Curious on our website, radiocurious.org. They're free to listen, download, and share anytime, anywhere, as my gift to you. We appreciate your comments, ideas, and suggestions, and like to hear from you. Email is curious@radiocurious.org. Snail mail is 280 North Oak Street, Ukiah, California, 95482. And the phone is 707-462-6541. Thomas Schoolcraft is our intern. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.